I just want to recognize you properly, and I'm not looking at the actual list of names of people here. Where are they? Right, thank you. You borrowed mine. I even wrote my name on Joan. Right. Mr. Randiku, is that right? Executive Director, where is he? Where? My God, you're in Mars. Then we've got Mr. Brian Wafaworowa.
Thank you.
Is that pronounced properly?
You pronounce it better than myself. Thank you.
Now, I don't know what that means, Buyani. Right. And then we have Ms. Shiham Shaikh. Is that correct? And you are the chairperson of the legal affairs, and Ryan is the chairperson of CASA. And then Mr. Andre Myberg. You do get around. All right. Go ahead.
It's now 2 o'clock.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for this opportunity to address this House again. I think as Professor Flynn indicated when he talked about 11th century England and the franchise model and why it was important for the franchisee to ensure that the members of the community were covered. We also had a very similar situation in Africa. If you look at the Griot in West Africa, the Imbongi or the Nyanduri in Isikosa in Southern Africa, where while it's that the people went to the field to look after their crops and look after their animals, and others went hunting, the Imbongi and the Griot remained behind, sharpening their skills in the history of the people concerned. It was the king's responsibility to make sure that they were looked after. So we are dealing with an age-old problem here around access and also looking after those who create. I just wanted to share some information with you on the publishing industry, where in 2015 it was on 5.3 billion rand in South Africa, and an average of 16% across different sectors accrued to authors, and this is really comparable to the profit range of about 10 to 15% for the industry. Outside sub-Saharan Africa, with the research that we have carried out in the International Publishers Association, it's bigger than music, film, and games put together, and that is just to suggest the scope that we have for this industry. Honorable Essen Hazen earlier on made an example of 5 African countries that got together and found copyright laws to be restrictive given the needs that they have. The counter-argument to that is that those countries find themselves in that situation because of the policy initiatives that they took in the 60s and 70s, where they looked at themselves as recipients of copyright developed elsewhere and not regard themselves as creators. So some of these policy changes really include funding. They also include the usurpation of copyright by the state on materials that are used there. So we have a lot of scope for growth. I just wanted to point out as well that we have about 7,657 employees, but when you look at the value chain, it goes as far as 20,000 across. I also want to emphasize, since a lot of the exceptions we're talking about relate to education, to emphasize the role that the textbook plays in education. And I will quote the UNESCO statement on textbooks, which says that in many developing countries where teachers, for various reasons, are not in a position to teach properly, the textbook remains the only guide for both the teacher and the learner into the curriculum. So I think there was an allusion that we can all become creators, including what's happening on platforms, including Netflix, including YouTube. But if that was the case, we wouldn't have a situation today where we are calling for access to more textbooks, because the space is saturated with materials. If you look at open education resources, the reason why textbooks remain that important is the curation process the alignment with the curriculum. In fact, the research that was done by the University of Hamburg in Germany indicated that the open system is such a jungle that teachers and learners get lost when they traverse that area. And Andrew Flynn, who was one of the Silicon Valley founders, has written a book which is called The Cult of the Amateur. And it basically deals with this whole notion that everybody can create useful information for education. So I just wanted to highlight that importance, because part of the impact of what we're dealing with is really on education materials. There's also another notion that basically says this industry is huge. If we make exceptions in education, then there is a lot more that players can go into and still have sustainable businesses. 60% of this industry in South Africa is in education. And when you consider that even those that are in the trade sector sell a lot of their stock into libraries and schools, it's even higher than that. In Africa, it's as high as 95%. I think undermining licenses at a time when a greater portion of future revenues will come from licensing will impact on digital education solutions. I'll speak to that a lot more later. Further exceptions place a disproportionate social burden on rights holders. I really agree that there is a problem. The challenge of our time is access. But at the same time, we must be careful that we distinguish between copyright and lack of funding. And we need to make sure that the burden of funding for education and other users falls on society and not creators and publishers, who are a very small part of the community we are talking about. Funding requirements should be borne by society through the state, not rights holders per se. Many provisions are made for vulnerable members of society, including people with visual impairment. I want to talk about copyright as an incentive to create and publish. Already, we have very high infringement and piracy, which is quite high at the moment. And there is a lot of uncertainty around this, and this could actually lead to greater unauthorized usage. Allowing users to transfer the copyright in and to share in royalties generated by such content will remunerate those users while reducing accruals to rights holders like Mrs. Mukwebe earlier on. Education writers write for a living, very little else. They write for a living. There is significant reduction in revenue that is estimated on the research that we have carried out. And I think there was a highlight earlier on that there is a lot of fear-mongering that is going on. I think there is very genuine concern. I have seen the figures on the licensing applications that are coming for next year. I can tell you that most of the universities have held back with regard to licensing because they are waiting for this bill, because they will believe that there will be no need for that. So the fear that you see and hear there is not unfounded. It's based on what people are observing. It could also reduce investment in education at a time when innovation is much needed. I want to talk about some of the industry initiatives that have been taken, because we really agree that the issue of access has to be sorted out, whether it's in housing, water, or medicine. The challenge of our time is in access. And I agree with Bill Gates where he pointed out that the success of our time is not the innovations that we make, but how we use those innovations to reduce inequities. So we agree with what is being sought here. We've been collaborating with the Department of Education to make sure that VIP learners get books at the same time as everybody else. We participated in Marrakesh Treaty. We were one of the few countries, probably the only one from Africa, which worked on the Marrakesh Treaty right to the end for visual impaired people. We are important players in the Global Access Books Consortium initiative. The reason why I'm highlighting this is you can see that these solutions are tailor-made towards the people that are affected by access. What we must avoid, which the bill fails to do, is generalizing and not coming up with different specific solutions for different user sectors. I like storytelling, and I would like to quote Mr. Gwede Mandashi here. when he said the danger is when you want fresh air and you open the window, the mosquitoes come in too. And I want to dwell on this a bit because on the user owner conundrum, what we fear is specifically something that I'll highlight here. I won't mention companies. But when we met in 1999 in Buenos Aires as the publishing industry, we were told by a software company, the biggest, that our days were numbered. It was a matter of 8 years and it would be over. We are still there. And what we have seen in this space is the attempt by conduit and platform operators to actually come and play in education. But the realization after so many years is that content, particularly curated content that is aimed at creating education solutions, is the driver of education outcomes. So we should make sure that when we talk about users, we are not talking about transmitters as well. Because what will happen with such transmitters is they will come onto with their platforms and systems, grab content that has been created by authors and publishers, and actually send it on as making available to further users, and then reduce what accrues to the author and the publisher, or even take it away altogether. So I want to caution you about that, and to think very seriously about what we mean. So this window that we are opening for fresh air must have a sieve that keeps mosquitoes out. I agree on innovation. There was a question that said, what does it look like from 2 years from now? What's coming is that what we are legislating for, which is mainly text, will be out in a few years' time, mainly because what we are going for are education solutions that include text, digital assets, logarithms for assessment, and many, many other things. Our role as publishers will be curation and aggregation. Publishers have become probably the biggest payers for licenses because the stuff that we bring in there is actually bought from elsewhere and it comes in to build. So if our licensing regime weakens, how do we get all these things together and compensate people that have created them? So we need to look at the future as well to say, what will this look like? So I would like to hand over to my colleague Shiham, who will look at the economic impact analysis.
Thank you, Ban. Thank you, Madam Chair. So based on all of these crucial concerns that my colleague Brian has raised, we commissioned a research study to be completed, and I know that all of you have a copy of that in front of you. So what you see is the orange booklet. Oh, okay, so what this study is, So what this study basically, what we decided to commission to do was to establish what would be the anticipated impact of these provisions, particularly the exceptions to the copyright, and what type of impact that would have on our industry. So the way we've done this, and the objective was, as I said, to quantify the possible impacts of fair use and exceptions for education as contained in the bill. This particular analysis went around two pieces of work. The first piece of work was to establish a baseline against which the impacts can be assessed, and the second was to survey a representative sample of publishers in South Africa, as well as collect responses from authors, which writes for the education sector as well. Okay, this analysis was completed by PricewaterhouseCoopers. As I said, you have a hard copy available in front of you, and it will be available electronically on the PASA website as well. So some of the key impacts that come across was that there would be a weighted average decline in sales of 33% in the industry. To the extent that the representative sample that we use represents the entire publishing industry, that would equate to approximately $2.1 billion revenue on the baseline. As a result of that, there'd be concomitant reductions in GDP, obviously on VAT and corporate tax revenue collections as well. Other key findings has been that imports will increase as a result of the reduced sales and associated returns on educational publishing. And similarly, exports will decrease now as a proportion of total sales. In terms of staff numbers, there's been a weighted decline in employment of 30%, which equates to about 1,250 full-time equivalent jobs. And as my colleague Brian had mentioned, because there is so many players in the value chain, even though there's a loss of 1,250 equivalent jobs, every person that's responsible down the line for various activities within publishing will also be impacted as well. Further findings of that impact study as well has been that 89% of publishers surveyed believe that the promulgation of this bill in its current form will impact negatively, not only on their operations, but also in terms of the organization's restructuring, retrenchments, and business closure. And again, we're stressing that there will be a decline in revenue to the tune of about 2.1 billion a year, and a reduction in licensing income via collective management as well. One other aspect that the assessment also covers is a comparative literature study where we looked at the Canadian experience as well. And the relevance of the Canadian experience here is that similarly they also went through an assessment of the changes in copyright to determine that balance between incentives for creativity and for allowing for dissemination of works as well. And I think someone had mentioned that the two, well, the Canadian experience and South African experience was different in terms of those reports. For the Canadian report, there wasn't a baseline that was established, which this report does, and this particular report for South Africa also covers the rationale for copyright laws in South Africa. So in terms of that literature study that was done in this assessment, one of the results of the adoption of the exceptions for education in Canada was between 2012 and 2015, you had a reduction in staff of about 10% in the educational publishers' activities. Collective licensing income in respect of public works was also substantially reduced. And then between 2011 and 2013, Canada's publishing industry contribution to GDP also shrunk by 16% as well. So these are just some of the findings within this report. We do invite you to read the report thoroughly. The PASA office will be available to address any further comments or any further questions that come out as a result of this report. Okay, I can now hand over to my colleague, Mr. Meiberg, for the legal aspect of the bill. 5 minutes.
I'll do my best.
You've had a dry run.
I've had a dry run, I must confess. Dalro, of course, has a collecting society for publishers, serves publishers, in which is why I've been in these two capacities. These are the legal aspects I would like to address. I'll go straight into it. Again, PASA made extensive submissions in 2015, and now in July, the 2015 submission also made suggestions for text. The most serious issue that PASA would like to raise and the reason why this report was commissioned are what we consider to be serious gaps in the impact assessment of the bill. We started with a Copyright Review Commission in 2011, which in detail investigated practices in the music industry. We had the draft National Intellectual Property Policy in 2013. A regulatory impact assessment of that was carried out, as we can see from the explanatory memorandum, but it has not been released. It is something that I think stakeholders would desperately like to see. The SEAS report was undertaken and presented to this committee on the 30th of May. It was not made available to stakeholders generally. Those stakeholders who subscribe to the Parliamentary Monitoring Group service were able to get it and download a 9 megabyte scan. We are concerned about what appears in the SEAS report because it contains no indication of any...
Some members have only been members of this committee, if you exclude July, 2 months. May not be familiar with the term. Is that the social impact assessment?
Socioeconomic impact assessment study report. This is a procedure that was devised by the Department of Planning in 2015, I believe. And they set out certain guidelines. One of the guidelines was that the report has to be made available when the legislation is introduced. And we would like the committee to ask itself the question whether the guidelines were complied with. It's for you to decide. So we have this gap that the bill will regulate all industries that work with copyright, and here lies our fundamental problem with the bill, that where findings that were made in relation to music do not apply to cinematograph films, to literary works, to artistic works, yet the same principles are drawn out over each item of copyright. Even within publishing, there are different forms of publishing. You'll see that in the July 2017 written submission. So the basic message that we want to put here is one size does not fit all. There are two clauses that have already been addressed previously, clauses 9 and 33 of the bill. Let me simply just say we would strongly recommend that they be rejected. Fair use is probably the most interesting part of the equation. So from our perspective, fair use is a statutorily codified defense to copyright infringement in the United States. It codifies practices that had been going on in the United States for 200 years before that. And I'm quite sure it works in the United States. Now, the fair use in the United States is determined by the four-factor test that we've already heard about. But it is not fair use is the name of the defense, which is why you see obviously these quotation marks around it. It is not about uses that are fair. It is about reproductions made without authorization where one of the four factors apply. That is fair use. It's not about fair contracts or fair treatment of authors. These are things that we have to address, but it's not fair use is not about that. It is not entirely, it's not the same as fair dealing either. I think pretty much everyone has made the same point now. Now, originally fair use in the United States until the 1970s, certainly there was no problem with it. It largely applied to new creative uses. And there was case law that developed over time that extended it more to more consumptive uses. And I think the most prominent one of that one is the Google Books case. Now, the problem with the Google Books case for publishers is not the making available of snippets and finding metadata online. The problem for publishers, if we may be frank about it, is that Google, with the cooperation of libraries, scanned their entire library content, the entire corpuses of works. So the basic deal, Professor Flynn Worker will no doubt be able to explain it in greater detail, but the basic concept behind it was Google said, we will digitize your library collection for free if we can keep a copy for these purposes. So Google obtained a digital copy of all of the works of participating libraries. There were certain exceptions. These exceptions are mentioned as facts in the judgment, but that was the basic outline. And I quote there from Judge Denny Chin's opinion in the of Court of First Instance. Before that, there was a settlement with publishers allowing them to opt out and to pull their books out of the Google Books system. So that was a preceding factor in that case. And as I say, the finding of fair use was not made on the act of the reproduction of the work. The finding of a fair use was made on the transformative making available of snippets and metadata. But it's the first part that we are worried about. That's what Brian was referring to earlier. So we can, there will be others who will speak about transplanting concepts from United States law where other elements have to be taken on board to make it balanced in South Africa. If that's what we want to do, we would not recommend that at all. There are issues that have to be addressed with the introduction of the making available right. We recommend that fair use is not the solution for that. word of warning from the former leader, the retired general counsel of the U.S. Copyright Office appears there. It's turned into a legal regime that permits regular, concerted, systematic, commercially purposed, 100% complete and uncompensated copying without permission day in, day out of millions of copyrighted books. We also have to ask ourselves, Google is not in a privileged position when it comes to this. Will there be other entities that would, if fair use would come in South Africa in this form, will there be other entities that will avail itself of the same gap in that will then appear in the law? There's a lot of work to be done. I think let's leave it at that. We've spoken about the other issues about users and uses before. We want to point out that the making available provisions are not complete. We have suggested text in 2015, and again that the one-size-fits-all process does not really work for, in this context.
There is our conclusion there, that authors and publishers are in the business of disseminating information, content, and knowledge to the public. In fact, that's what the word publish means. They do so at great cost of time and resources and need fair compensation to be able to continue doing so. A delicate balance needs to be struck between access and the legitimate expectations of rights holders. If it is imbalanced in favor of users, this will come at the cost of the production of quality and reliable information. My wish is to say 30 years from now, Africa will be operating at the same level as other knowledge generators and exchanging information rather than begging. If we continue undermining creativity, we will still be going to the West 30 years from now and begging them for their copyright, for their own information, and we need to avoid that.
Thank you very much. Members, as I think Mr. Hermans explained, is that we, the South African Book Development Council is not here today, remember, and as the next one is not entirely in this, you know, directly related, although it's broadly in this field, we need to give you the opportunity now for the engagement on the public, the Publishers Associates. So if you have any comments or questions, now's the time to address them. And a couple of minutes or so, can I see by show of hands? Before that, where's Honourable Elberts, Mr. Hermans, because he's been getting here for the last 5 hours. A delayed flight. They've now landed. Thank you. Right. Hands, can we see who wants to comment or raise a question? Honourable Williams, Honourable MacPherson, who else?
Thank you, Chairperson. Firstly, I just want to welcome your input. I just have a question on fair use. You seem to be completely anti-fair use in its entirety. Is there any elements of the fair use practice that you would support? Thank you.
Right, Honourable MacPherson.
Thank you very much, Mr. Meyerberg. With respect to your presentation that says that already some universities have not renewed their copying licenses in anticipation of the bill, what are the effects of that on the academic calendar? Does it mean that students don't have access to information? Does it mean that people won't be able to study? If you could just expand on that, please. And then I have a question for the DTI. Under they say that the CS report has not been made available by DTI. Why is that? And is it true that it contains no indication of independent research? And if so, why is that?
Honourable MacPherson, DTR won't be responding today, even some of the questions I've raised, okay, until the end. But you've heard the question, and we've noted it, I'm sure Mr. Herbert or Mr. Medema has, which must be responded to in due course, all right? Did you have another comment, Honourable MacPherson, or question? No. What I would like to ask you, there was a reference made to different jurisdictions in this regard, and with changes coming about, how the issue of jobs came up, you know, led to unemployment, etc. But what I would like to ask, Pasa, there's no doubt that we are very fast approaching a different mode of publishing, if I may put it that way. Now, you know, I think we would all agree you can't publish fresh legislation every 2 years. So somehow, we have got to encompass these issues, or at least not prevent such different modes from taking place. Because literally what will happen is the Berlin Wall will fall. No sooner have we adopted fresh legislation. So there is a need for us to consider these other ways and keep the principles in mind. What are these principles? What are the principles that PASA believes are critical to the writers, the authors, the originators' protection? What is it? So that you're able to rise above a current mode, if I may put it that way. You know, and I think that's going to be extremely helpful to the legislators, because you have certain expertise that we don't have. Do you follow? And we need that information. The other issue I'd like to raise, many of you made references to policy, am I right, throughout the morning and again now. And I understand, am I right, Mr. Herman? Where is the policy? The policy. You see, you made references to the social and economic impact study not being released, am I right, or available? But it is in this pack. Do you not have it yet? It's not public. So the committee has it. Now, I'm raising these issues. I'm sure all of you are aware how critical they are. We as legislators have them. Do you understand? But the general public doesn't. Is that correct, Mr. Herman? Now, I need you on record.
Mr. Officer, we were provided with a copy of the report. DTI will have to respond to the reasons why it's not to it. I can't respond.
Okay. I want, you know, we conduct an open process, you see? So it's not our report. We've been given a report. All right? So that is a question we ourselves may wish to raise. But on the basis of what you've heard now, some are very quick, clear clarifications, others not so quick and clear. Could you carry on then, Pasa?
Thank you. I will take the question on what happens if there is no renewal, and then the question on the different modes of publishing, and I will leave the other questions to my colleagues. On the question, the fair use question to my colleague, Andre, on the question of new renewal, we said what we are worried about are the unintended consequences of what is happening. So if the anticipation is correct and they get their way, then they were right not to renew. So they will use it the way they understand the bill allows them to. And I don't think that even the understanding is accurate. We have a lot of test cases on whether that understanding is correct or not, given the confusion that was illustrated around how it is articulated at the moment. If it says no, they cannot do what they anticipated, what it will basically mean is that either they will have a wrong interpretation and continue copying illegally, and then there will be no accrual to the authors as a result of that. So we really think that either way it creates malpractice, unfair usage. And I must say that we have never pursued any education users of our content. We call it unauthorized usage, but we have pursued piracy, where somebody comes in, copies and sells to begin to compete with us. The other part is we are not oblivious to the changes. In fact, a lot of the content that is now in the market is digital. You know about Minister Panyaza Lusufi's initiative with the paperless schools. We are participants in that. The fear that we have, though, is that what we have become is no longer traditional publishers who put everything in one book and then sell it as in the past. We have become curators. We go to companies that create digital assets. We license those to bring them in. We go to authors. We take their text. We put it in. We work with companies like Google for their platforms in terms of transmission. We work with Vodacom in terms of bandwidth and the presentation of that information. The reason why we didn't go as fast as we should have gone, given that 1999 example I was given, was that the conduit operators at some stage believed that they could do it without content. Now there is a realization and there is a real collaboration. There is not a single activity that we have carried out without a data company, a platform company, a copyright company, and all this stuff is now being brought together. So the user owner conundrum will actually be more difficult in the future, because we no longer have one entity. There are many people that are contributing to this process. So with the digital rights management systems, data, metadata, digital object identifiers, there are systems that identify who has contributed to what to this, and they are compensated accordingly. So we have embraced this, and we want to make sure that the bill that we come up with now will allow us to create solutions that will improve education outcomes by harnessing technology. And this is not even 5 years away from now. I think it's coming upon us quickly, and we are taking it on. And we need the law to help us do just that. Thank you.
Much. Any other comments here? There were some other questions, yes?
Yes, to respond to the Honourable Williams' question about supporting fair use. Publishers have always cautioned about it. There are the implications that one has to bear in mind. It's what Brian mentioned about you open the windows and the mosquitoes comes in. There are consequences that you have to take into account. And so publishers have always sounded a word of caution. In the case of the bill, it is an alarm bell ringing warning, because as we saw from the earlier presentations, the purposes to which fair use is put in the United States is, they list a couple of examples. They insert the words such as, and they insert a couple of examples, which I'm trying to find now unsuccessfully, but criticism, comment, news reporting, teaching, scholarship, and research. The bill has got about 8 or 9 of them, including public administration, education, which is of particular interest to publishers, quite a number of them. Now, in South Africa, we have the Esdem Generis rule in interpretation of statutes. If we were to insert the words such as before that list of 8, then there's really no there's no way of trying to draw from that list a type of example that you could follow when coming up with a fair use defense. And fair use defense becomes I know fair use when I see it, which is a wry comment that has been expressed by a number of American jurists. So certainly the fair use as proposed in the bill, with such as, especially with the words such as, we ring alarm bells against.
I want to add to what Brian says. Libraries, universities, and schools are the customers of publishers. Publishers, no one, no supplier likes to sue his customer, especially when you're looking at a long-term agreement like a license agreement. And Brian has confirmed to us that there is no record in South Africa of publishers having sued their library customers for taking liberties with their copyright works. There are no such cases that we are aware of. In the United States, there are a couple of those cases. There's one case called Georgia State University, which has been running since 2008. And the case started in 2008 after publishers and the customer library desperately tried to settle the fair use principles relating to the reproduction of copyright works into course packs. So that case has been bouncing between Court of the First Instance, the Appeal Court, and back again for 9 years now. And that is a direct result of different interpretations of fair use, different interpretations of fair use between the lower court and the appeal court in the state of Georgia.
Thank you very much. Yes, Honourable William.
Chairperson, I just have a follow-up on my question. So as the Act, the amendment, appears before us, it doesn't talk to such as. It doesn't appear. So do you then agree with the clause on fair use, but without the words such as?
Thank you.
Chair, Mr. Williams, no, we don't, because of the addition of the many other items that have been put in there. Those other items are not even legitimate purposes for fair use in the United States, and this is why the rights holder support organizations have been raising these issues with you this morning.
Right. Does that clarify it? Yes.
So what I'd like request from you then is for you to just write down the things that you do think could fall under fair use in that clause that you agree with, and then send it to our secretary so they can give it to us. Thank you.
Right. I think, yes, they're not asking for a response now. I must say I never got what I thought as an adequate comment on the point I made. Is it because it's just beyond our radar screen, or what? Told you that what, you know, our challenge here as legislators is to develop legislation in this fast-changing environment of ours that will be there for at least another 5 to 8 years before it's reviewed. And there have been references to this not being possible. You indicate yourself, you believe you've become curators. You know, is there any way we can overcome this? Is our language too limited to accommodate the advanced technological advances? Maybe it's a language issue. I don't know. We need you to tell us. You're the experts.
The approach that we take in the industry is one that says we need to use technology to resolve some of the problems that eluded us in the print environment. One of those is to basically say, whilst you are developing material for the ordinary students, how do you hive off material at the same time that is in a format that is required by learners with visual impairment so that they get it at the same time. The others is using flexible technology like DAISY to make sure that you can adjust it according to the reader's needs. The principles of creator, user, and fair use remain. I think what changes is the rate at which things can be changed, and that's where it begins to speak to the issues of making users also rights holders who should be compensated. Because I can tell you now, when I go to what is traditionally a publishing conference, there are more software and gadget companies than traditional publishers, which means they are moving into education. So everybody in there is making a contribution that is identifiable, and that contribution can be compensated adequately from author to the company that provides the transmitting data, to the company that provides the platform, to the company that does the curation. It's not difficult to identify those. What is difficult and will create problems is the conflation of the roles that people who are identified as users at times also become rights holders who have to be compensated. So some of the issues that we are highlighting, particularly around the user owner conundrum, will actually accentuate the problems that we are dealing with in copyright. But I don't think that the principles are different going into it. It enables us to do a lot more in terms of access. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Mr. Wafo Wairoa. Thank you. And also to yourself, Mr. Myberg, and Ms. Shaikh. Thank you. And anyone else from yourself here. You have assisted us, and I'm sure you will provide us with the information and writing that was requested. Thank you. Honourable members, we now move on to the South African Institute for Intellectual Property Law, right? And we welcome Ms. Duplessis, the fellow of the South African Institute for Intellectual Property Law and the chairperson of the committee. Mr. Hollis, another fellow of that institute. Mr. Pretorius, where's Mr. Pretorius there? You're a fellow of SAIPO and an associate of Unsidles. And Mr. Biermann, again another fellow and an associate of Adams and Adams. I see both Mr. Hollis and Mr. Biermann come from Adam and Adams. In fact, three of you do. Yeah, that's why I say three of you. Right. So, at this point then, you have the floor. Who's going to lead up?
Honourable Madam Chair, thank you very much. Honourable members of the committee and colleagues, I think we are all more or less devastated by this time, after all that we've heard relating to the bill. But I think it's such an important topic that please allow me, as the oldest probably in the room today, to add something. This presentation is made on behalf of the Institute, the South African Institute of Intellectual Property Law. The Institute has submitted written comments. We are also here on behalf of the Law Society of South Africa. The Law Society supported in writing the comments submitted by the Institute. I'm a fellow of the Institute, and I'm also chairperson of the Committee of Intellectual Property of the Law Society of South Africa, and that is the reason for my mandate. Now, I've practiced as an attorney in the field of intellectual property law since 1965. And I think, Madam Chair, you will understand if I ask Mr. Lechetenji, couldn't we just revert to the 1965 Copyright Act? I know it much better than the bill that I have to study at the moment, but that was just an attempt to show that we need to keep up with the changing times. So we need to look at this bill very, very accurately. I'll be assisted by my colleague, Stephen Hollis, who is also a fellow of the Institute. He's also been in practice for a long time, and he participated in the preparation of the submission by the Institute. The Institute, some background information, is a voluntary association. It was created in 1954. You have it in front of you. It is independent, and it does not present a specific client group. The members are all practicing attorneys or academics or business people or students, all committed to the protection and enforcement of intellectual property rights. And the members represent a very wide spread of clients. So the input comes from small businesses, big businesses, publishers, creators, performers, whatever. A very wide range of interest groups will be represented here. The Law Society, similarly, is a voluntary association established in 1998. Independent does not represent any specific client group. The constituent bodies are the statutory law societies and the Black Lawyers Association and the National Association for Democratic Lawyers. Again, the attorneys who are members of these bodies represent a very wide range of client interests, both national and international, but the bodies come from an independent, unbiased perspective. Now, the main objective of both these bodies is to preserve and to promote a legal dispensation of integrity and legality, but also, aligned with the needs and imperatives of the country. So both these bodies are acutely aware of the needs and the demands of the country at a given point in time, and they believe that those needs and the imperatives should be addressed, hopefully resolved, but not always possible. But both these associations are unbiased and they have no commercial preference. Now, yes, we agree there is a need for the Copyright Act to be updated. The current copyright law is generally accepted to be a fairly good system. It has been enforced, as we heard, since 1978, and there is consensus that the law must be modernized and updated. Many technological developments have taken place. We've heard this afternoon of the incredibly difficult concepts to understand sometimes of the technological developments that have taken place. But we have to take that into account. The Act must be amended to cater for those technological developments and needs, but within a proper legal framework. The need for members of the public to have greater access to copyright works and to make greater use of copyright works, that has also increased. And the Act must be amended to provide for these needs, but on an equitable and feasible basis. The needs of specific sectors of the public, like students, disabled persons, performers, so forth, to have access and to make use of copyright works, that is also recognized. But again, the Act will have to be amended to make provision for these needs, but on an equitable basis. But finally, the importance is recognized to encourage and to enable creative artists and creative industries, local creative artists, local creative industries. And they must also benefit from their creative work, and their input must be recognized. The Act must be amended and updated to enable these groups to benefit, but on an equitable basis. So we state unequivocally that the updating and modernization of the Copyright Act is necessary, is timely, and is supported.
Comfortable, but I thought that you were a bit low myself.
You mean
it's
a little
important
louder?
That everyone hears you.
Okay. I'll try. Just let me know. Is that better? Okay, I'll move closer to this. But what we want to say as two independent bodies, that the changes must be done in a legally correct and an effective manner, and the outcome in all cases must create a fair and equitable dispensation. Without that, I don't think we can move forward. The updating and the modernization of the current Copyright Act is important, but it has to take into account several principles and guidelines. First of all, and that has been referred to this morning, South Africa has to implement, but also adhere to, the international treaties and instruments that the country needs and those that the countries have already acceded to. That has been mentioned. We need to stay abreast with international legal developments. South Africa has to take note of technological developments, including also the legal solutions applied in other countries. But, and I want to state that very firmly, the belief is from the side of the Institute and the Law Society that this should happen without compromising the existing legal dispensation of the country and without slavishly adopting legal models from other countries. We must create a model that works for our country. But we can take into account what other countries have done and make use of the best aspects of their models. South Africa has to take into account the need to establish a legal system that will empower and enable and ultimately benefit local creators, local artists, local composers, local performers and students, but also the local creative industries. So the act and the law that we create must enable our own people to make optimal use of the principles and also to reap the benefits of their efforts. But I also think, and that is the attitude of the Institute, that in amending the Copyright Act, the overall domestic legal dispensation in the broader field of intellectual property must be taken into account. We should not compromise long-standing fundamental principles, and one of those, and that has been referred to frequently in the course of today, is a balance of rights. Whatever we create by way of a new copyright dispensation must be based on a balance of rights. Yes, South Africa should take into account all the findings and the recommendations of the various bodies that have investigated intellectual property and specifically copyright and try and implement that in our own legal context. Now, I am not certain that it can be said that all of these principles and guidelines have actually been taken into account in drafting the current bill. I think they were there on the horizon, but when drafting the actual legislative provisions, perhaps some of the principles may have fallen on the wayside. If we look at the Copyright Amendment Bill 2017, it has come a long way. The first one was published in 2015. It elicited very, very extensive and also very negative comment. The position of the Institute and the Law Society is that the 2017 bill is an improvement on the 2015 bill. But again, it is eliciting widespread comment, and we must make the best use of the positive comments that come from the various stakeholders. And the Portfolio Committee, the members here, will have to address all of the stakeholder submissions, emphasizing different aspects of the law, from policy positions to the right to access, to the right to use. But the members must also be aware of the shortcomings of the bill. And I think it will be very difficult for the committee members to make sense of all of the conflicting submissions that will be made to them over the next 3 days. I want to propose that the committee should perhaps consider appointing a task team of experts. I know that, Madam Chair, you have invited all the presenters to submit written proposals of how the bill can be improved. I think if we could get those people to sit around a table and debate their proposals. They come with their written proposals, they debate their proposals, they work through the entire bill and they try and improve. You will probably end up with a bill that is workable and that is generally acceptable. I think such a task team could sit down and debate all of the arguments that we have heard today and also look critically but also with interest at the legal models used in other countries, and also the economic factors that are inherent in copyright law, and come up with solutions which are workable. And hopefully that task team will be able also to convene another stakeholder consultation situation where outsiders can also make submissions. I think it's not possible within 20 minutes to deal fully with all of the problematic issues.
I ought to correct you. I'm not sure if Mr. Hermans explained that
you do have a longer period and more time. I've heard you mention the 20 minutes three or four times now. All right, so go ahead.
Okay, thank you very much, Madam Chair. I'll try and talk as fast as I can. I think the written submissions will address all of these issues much more fully than we can do that here, but we want to focus on the bill now, my colleague and I. We want to point out certain provisions that need to be looked at critically. And we will single out a number of crucial legal issues, and I think those legal issues arise from ill-considered legislative provisions. They have to be reconsidered. For example, we need to look at the new enforceable package rights, such as the user royalty right and the resale royalty right. Those are both rights packages which may have merit, but the way in which they have been formulated in the Act probably will not work in practice. We have to look at the new or extended exceptions to already existing enforceable rights. We are looking at the fair use concessions that has elicited already extensive debate, and yes, the model will have to be relooked very carefully to fit it into our local legal dispensation. There are also other extended exceptions which have been introduced into the Copyright Bill, but independently of the fair use exception. Those must also be looked at very carefully. There are also unclear terms and concepts in the bill, and that has also been referred to, and I will refer to those too, as some ill-considered outcomes. For example, the continuous use of the phrase user, performer, owner, producer, author. User, performer, owner, producer, author. In various provisions, not always clear what that phrase is supposed to imply. One has to identify the party, the specific party, who is entitled to a right or who is obliged to give effect to a certain stipulation. We need to look at the provisions for orphan works. We've looked at that already. I think the model is not bad, but it has to be refined. And there are problems with orphan works. We need to look at state-owned intellectual property copyright provisions. Not that the state is not allowed to own, but how will it work in practice? And that needs to be refined. And then we have to look at the duration of an assignment of copyright. The duration of an assignment has been limited to 25 years. We have to look at the implications of that. Now, the current legal issues that I would like to raise, first of all, has to do with the user royalty right. Now, I presume that the members of the committee have had an opportunity of looking at the current Copyright Act, and they know that there are 9 categories of copyright works that have been identified in Section 2 of the Act. They are all different, and I am not sure that one can apply the same legal provisions to each one of those 9 different types of copyright works. For example, where the bill introduces the user royalty rights, this is only in respect of 4 of these categories, in respect of literary works, musical works, artistic works, and cinematic or films. Now, theoretically, some of the other categories of copyright works can also be used. They have the potential to be usable, and yet they are not subject to a user royalty right. This appears to be discriminatory, and I think one should look very carefully as to why the user royalty right has been limited only to certain works. If one looks at the bill, sections 4, 5, and 6, where the user royalty right is introduced, the wording is sometimes a bit confusing. The bill states that despite the transfer of copyright in the work concerned by the user, performer, owner, producer, or author, it is impossible that each one of them could possibly have the right to transfer copyright. So that introductory phrase already is a bit puzzling. Then it goes on to say that the user, performer, owner, producer, or author of such work shall have the right to claim an equal portion of the royalty payable for the use of such copyright work. So the user can claim a user royalty right, but is also obliged to pay a user royalty right. I think there is a problem there, and it has to be sorted out and clearly defined. As I said, this provision simply does not make sense. It has to be made very clear which party is liable to pay the user royalty, and to which party the royalty must be paid, and to which party the claim for the user royalty must be addressed. If I believe I am entitled to a user royalty, who must I approach to pay my user royalty? Must the author of the copyright work or the owner of the copyright work pay the user, since the user has the right to claim? Or must the user pay the author or the copyright owner, because the user is using the work? And that is not clear from the current way in which the Act has been formulated. It has to be corrected to make quite clear who is entitled to that royalty and who is obliged to pay it. And exactly what does the term use of a copyright work mean? We have dealt with it. Many of the presenters explained that use is not a concept that is defined in the Act. If I buy a book and I read the book, am I using the book? And must I now pay a user royalty right? To whom? To the user, to the performer, to the owner, to the producer, or to the author? Doesn't make sense. If I listen to a musical work after a heavy day in Parliament, am I using that musical work and must I pay a user royalty right? It cannot be. So the formulation really requires clarity and certainty. But strangely enough, because the user royalty right has not been applied to a sound recording, if I listen to a sound recording, I'm not obliged to pay a user royalty right. Or if I use a computer program, it seems to me I'm not obliged to pay a user royalty right. So my suggestion is those clauses must be looked at very carefully, must be rephrased in a legally correct and certain manner. It is also very important to note the new Section 39B, which will be introduced into the Act, namely that any contract which purports to renounce a right afforded by the Act shall be unenforceable. So nobody can renounce this right to a user royalty payment. I think that must be reconsidered. Another crucial legal issue is the resale royalty right. Also an important one, we heard about it. My understanding from the very start was that the objective with the resale royalty right was primarily to benefit emerging young creative artists of our country by enabling them to benefit from the sales of their works. I'm not clear that this objective is in fact achieved. Many of the aspects of the current royalty user provision simply do not make sense to me. In terms of section 9B1, the author of an artistic work, and remember, an artistic work has a very, very wide definition. It's not only a painting or a sculpture or a drawing. It's even a photograph. It's a work of architecture. It's also a work of craftsmanship. What we're sitting on is designed by a person who designed the work of craftsmanship. And the author of any artistic work will have an inalienable right to receive royalties on the commercial resale of the work subsequent to the first transfer by the user of the work. That last phrase makes no sense. But the effect is that if I'm an architect and I design a building, if there's a subsequent sale of the building and a subsequent one, theoretically I am entitled to a resale royalty right. If I'm the designer of the armchair in which I sit in my study, And if that share is sold and sold again and sold again, I'm entitled to a resale royalty right. That could not have been the intention with that provision. I think that provision will have to be reconsidered very carefully and redefined. The next aspect of the resale royalty right is that the royalty shall be payable at a rate to be prescribed by the minister. Now, there is no provision at the moment for a sliding scale. So it seems to me the resale royalty right will be at a rate applied to the most expensive painting, the Irma Stern going for 10 million rand, the same rate will apply as the price for a painting by an emerging artist. So the person that we want to empower to gain from the sales of his products will get very little in comparison to the well-known artist whose artistic works will be sold at a very high price. Was that the intention of the legislature? I think we need to look at that very importantly. What is interesting is that Section 9B3 then uses this phrase again, the user, performer, owner, producer or author of an artistic work shall be entitled to the resale royalty right. So now it seems to me even the user of a creative work will be entitled to the resale royalty right. If I'm a tenant in a building and the building is sold, am I entitled to a user royalty right? Madam Chair, I think your collection of people who have made inputs must put forward written proposals on how the system can be improved to make it a workable system to benefit what we want to achieve, and that is the emerging artists, the emerging creators, the emerging authors. There are some other aspects which I will not even deal with at the moment. But Section 9B4 says that the resale royalty right will apply whether or not the author was the first user, performer, owner, producer, or author of a copyright in the work. That makes no legal sense. We need to rephrase that. It creates confusion.
Can I interrupt you there for one moment?
Yes.
You see, I know you've actually presented and made inputs before me in the past. And I've got a very good memory. That voice is unmistakable. Now, that was about 5-6 years ago, wasn't it?
Yes.
Now, you know from then that what we asked people to do, this is valuable in its own right. But what is even more helpful for legislators is when you identify certain issues, and you have made reference to specific clauses, which is very helpful, which some of your colleagues in this area have not done, then make a proposal. If this is what is intended, you would have proposed X, because it would seem as if such approaches have been utilized in other countries as well. And you would have had a greater understanding of this than perhaps the current legislators. So please, you need to try and assist us by coming forward with that. So critique, fine, well and good and constructive. It will be even more valuable. Add some value now. Thank you.
Madam Chair, yes, I'm acutely aware of what you're saying. Again, time is a bit of a factor. But if there is time, and I think we need time to get this bill into perfect order, then yes, written submissions will be made with proposals on how the wording can be improved to make it workable. I undertake to do that. My colleague will certainly assist.
Thank you.
There is, I think I must not deal further on the resale royalty right. There are some other provisions which also are questionable, such as it expires 50 years from the end of the calendar year in which the author died, but a according to the provision, other people also are entitled to the user royalty rights, so it simply does not make sense. I think it would be important also to specify who will be responsible for paying the resale royalty rights. Is it the person who buys this very expensive painting? Must that person pay all the others? Is it the seller who might not be inclined to do that? He'd rather hang on to his painting than to sell it if he has to pay a big royalty. Or is it the auctioneer who facilitates the sale? So I think we need to clarify who will be responsible for the payments. I want to deal very briefly with the exceptions that we've already dealt with. At the moment, our Copyright Act has certain packages of tailor-made exclusive rights and exceptions made to fit in with the different categories of copyright works. And the current Act stipulates specific exceptions where the carrying out of a certain act will not be deemed to be an infringement of copyright. This system has always been seen as a fair and balanced and equitable dispensation, balancing the right between the copyright owners and the people who need to get access to copyright works. But that system has to be updated. It has to be modernized. I agree with that. The Institute agrees with it. The Law Society agrees with it. We have to make provision for the new demands arising from the digital era and the technological developments and all of that, and also the needs of disabled people. Now, what has happened now is that Section 12.1 of the Act has been replaced with the fair use system, which is, as we've heard, which originated in the US. And 8 purposes have been set out with the 4-factor test and all of that. The question is that it is not clear that that system has been clearly and well enough defined to fit in with our current system of 9 categories of copyright works, which all have different exercisable aspects. It is noteworthy that the concept fair dealing is no longer very visible in the provisions, although it still arises from time to time. And the law of fair dealing has been part of the South African law for many decades. Now, to replace it with a fair use system, which functions on a different basis, may entail consequences that have not yet been sorted out properly. My proposal will then be that one should look carefully, and Madam Chair, you've indicated a proposal must be submitted on how that particular set of exceptions can be formulated to work effectively within our current legal environment. And yes, that will have to be done. It can be done. It can be done. It will be done. What is interesting is that apart from replacing Section 12.1 of the Act, there is a further new Section 12A which has been introduced with a long list of acts, again applicable to all copyright works, which will not constitute infringement. And I think it will have to be made very clear whether these acts also form part of the fair use package or whether it is a separate and new set of exceptions. Some are justifiable. Some, I think, are repetitive. I have compared some of the provisions in the new Section 12A and the new replacement of Section 12.1, and they are repetitive. So it is not clear why certain acts have to be repeated if they are both exceptions from the copyright rights. That will have to be looked at very carefully. At the moment, thank you.
You've got 10 minutes.
I've got 10 minutes.
And I'm going to suggest you give voice the rest to your other colleagues familiar with this bill.
Yes.
Right.
Absolutely. I think what I have pointed out on page 9 of the slides is that we will have to accept that some of the new concessions are necessary. The making of temporary or incidental copies, the making of recordings of a work for academic and educational purposes, and the use of a computer program for certain research purposes, all of those are very important, especially the accessible format copies for persons with disabilities. We must just look very carefully that the exceptions are properly formulated and will work in the new dispensation. I said on page 20, the revision of the current exception provisions in the Act is supported and is indeed necessary. However, any new dispensation must preserve a balance between the rights of authors and copyright owners and the rights of potential users, including performers, producers, students, and all of the others. I think it is important that we should reassess the ambit and the potential consequences of the proposed exceptions. I leave it at that. Then I want to quickly refer to some unclear concepts and terminology, and that is on page 22 of the presentation. The bill uses very frequently that phrase user, performer, owner, producer, author, and it is not always clear why that is necessary. This phrase is undefined, it lacks clarity, it leads to confusion. I think we have to, wherever that phrase is used, have to look very carefully and use the correct term, whether we mean user or copyright owner or author or whatever, and use the correct term, not use the alternative phrase. The orphan works, I think, has to be looked at again, especially what happens with the situation when the author of an orphan work is located again. The author is not the person who necessarily has the right. It could be the copyright owner. So one has to look at who will have the right in respect of that orphan work. And I'm not sure how easy that will be, but it needs to be addressed. The state-owned copyright, what worries me is that I'm not clear that cognizance was taken of the Act on IP Rights from Publicly Financed Research and Development, which also has provisions conferring certain rights, certain intellectual property rights, including copyright, to the institutions or the research councils. We have to make sure that these two pieces of legislation are properly aligned. There are some ill-considered outcomes. The limitation of the assignment of copyright to 25 years, I think, may present a problem. It seems to be the introduction of the reversionary right, but it's not clear from the bill to whom the rights will revert. Will it be to the author or to the copyright owner? And I think that particular limitation of assignment rights should be looked at very carefully because it could have unintended outcomes. It could create very difficult situations where there are long-term contracts dealing with the commercialization of copyright works. And if the assignment ends after 25 years abruptly, it could create a problem. I think at this stage, I merely want to say the last remark will have to do with policy issues. I think it is important that when reassessing the bill, that one should look very carefully at policy positions which appear from the bill. And I will leave it at that. You have it in front of you. The whole concept of use, whether use is a restricted or a permitted act, is not clear. The concept of use must be looked at very carefully, also from a policy perspective, not only from the formulation of the provisions, and the whole system of unfair use, and that is where my colleague will come in. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, honourable members of the committee. Yes, we've been certainly discussing, this seems to be the one of the key issues, whether we follow, adopt a US-style system of fair use in South African law, whether we simply develop our law by importing legislation from another jurisdiction which shares no common law with South Africa in that regard. I just want to point out from a legal point of view, I'm not going to rehash the arguments raised from industry, But there are a few legal concerns that the committee should bear in mind when approaching this issue. Firstly, of course, it's important to develop our own solution in South Africa. And currently, as my colleague pointed out, we've got a system of fair dealing. And fair dealing and fair use is not the same term. It's got a very specific legal meaning in terms of the South African copyright history and setup. So to refer to the two, and many of the protagonists of the fair use system will say, but it's a matter of semantics. It's the same thing. You've already got it, so to speak. It's not the case. Fair dealing is a very sophisticated system, and we're looking at our 1978 legislation, and we all recognize the need to update that legislation. But I think it has to be said that that piece of legislation is a rather sophisticated piece of legislation which has regulated all of our relevant industries for so many years quite effectively. The amount of litigation in the copyright area and also litigation in the field of fair dealing has been very limited. So there doesn't immediately appear to be a very clear and urgent problem to address, although we all agree that with digital developments and so forth, we need to bring our law in line with how the world is moving. One of the key issues from a legal point of view is if you adopt the US style system and doctrine of fair use, you're not simply importing a legal principle into our law, you're in fact importing about 200 years worth of United States case law into our law. When our first courts will need to determine whether a certain case, if the defendant raises the issue of fair use, the court will not be able to look where it normally looks and searches for guidance, which is the EU and the UK, countries and jurisdictions with whom and with which we share legal precedent, legal development, and in fact legal heritage, our common law ancestry. That cannot be ignored. So when the first court will need to interpret whether something amounts to fair use, where will the court need to look to interpret this open-ended use system? As a matter of fact, the court will need to look towards the United States courts, which is unprecedented. So what about our common law ancestors? Not much have been made of it, except from the, I think the Publishing Association referred to a PwC report. There's other reports as well that the committee should look to for guidance, in my view. One of them being the 2011 Hargreaves report, which is an independent commission, commissioned in fact by Prime Minister David Cameron at the time, to look at whether legislative provisions in the UK and also in the EU are restrictive and inhibit economic and industrial growth and innovation. And it was found in that report that indeed and I read directly from the report, if I may. The review considered whether the more comprehensive American approach to copyright exceptions based upon the so-called fair use defense would be beneficial in the UK. We concluded that importing fair use wholesale was unlikely to be legally feasible in Europe and that the UK would achieve many of its benefits by taking up copyright exceptions already permitted under EU law and arguing for an additional exception designed to enable EU copyright law to accommodate future technological change where it does not threaten copyright owners. This brings me to, the report also mentioned that a big danger of simply importing this system is it could lead to vagueness in law. Now in the United States, one of the reasons why the fair use doctrine might work well is it is a rather litigious society, and secondly, it's also a legal system where punitive damages are awarded in matters. So you've probably all read the cases where when the Napster litigation was going on with the illegal peer-to-peer music sharing, where you had farcical situations actually where housewives were slapped with massive damages awards for making music available on a peer-to-peer network to the effect of hundreds of millions of dollars. So the effect of that is in the United States litigation sort of practice, defendants, people are risk averse. They will rather steer away from potentially infringing, as they could incur a massive punitive damages award. That is simply not the case in South Africa. In South Africa, our courts do not award big monetary awards which could threaten the commercial interests of parties who make unauthorized and large-scale use of copyright-protected materials. In South Africa, the parties who are often at the wrong end of the deal are the very creatives that our 2011 CRC report spoke about and recommended that we need to urgently look at how to galvanize our creative sector. Now, if you look at the importation, the relaxation of our current very clear legal exceptions as to copyright infringement and merely importing a foreign doctrine and case law system mechanism on the bequest of protagonists of this so-called, let's say, user access-oriented system that's going on around the world, please just bear in mind that in many countries it is being rebutted, including the UK, the EU, Canada, Australia, where we share common law. So why is there this need and this burning desire to look towards the United States to implement a foreign principle that does not necessarily have application in our law, especially in the absence of an empirical study, a peer-to-peer reviewed document which clearly shows the economic benefits? As a matter of fact, if we consider the responses from independent inquiries from these jurisdictions and countries which we share heritage and common law with, it is clear what their response is. It's that the economic and innovative benefits are actually largely exaggerated by the reports from academics that are connected to this global movement to promote user access, to promote user access versus the rights of creators and owners. And I think we should definitely not lose focus of the valuable recommendations made in the CRC report, which seem to be largely ignored if we implement provisions such as some of the ones discussed by my colleague, introducing user royalty rights for the use of recorded music, which is another indication of this sort of, let's call it a shift in focus from what was proposed in 2011 by Judge Farlam, to saying, look, let's leave the creators for now, let's focus more on the rights of those who want to access the information and those who might actually not wish to pay royalties or market-related royalties for such use. We need to look back at the...
Is it Mr. Hollis?
Yes, Madam Chair.
You do need to close off now.
Okay, so thank you. I think we need to consider whether it's necessary to take a sledgehammer to our copyright legislation and to try to address this issue that the tech industry have brought forward to say the current very specific exceptions to our copyright infringement, which introduces clarity to our law, should be amended by not using a scalpel, maybe if it's possible to do so, to fine-tune the law as our common law ancestors have done, but to obliterate the current exception clauses, to ignore the fact that different works are used differently, accessed differently, commercialized differently in different industries. Our current copyright legislation deals with the exceptions almost on a work-by-work basis, which is very helpful. Those clauses can be fine-tuned through collaborations with industry, for instance, whether from stakeholders in the publication, the technology, the creative sectors, all concerned, to ensure that it's quite clear when somebody infringes copyright in South Africa and not vague. If you've got large organizations who can hide behind the veil of claiming to have a legal defense of fair use, and you've got a poor artist, what right does that artist have, or what accessibility does he have to courts and to financial support to take the matter to court and to see it through? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. It is Mr., isn't it, Mr. Hollis?
Yes.
Right. Thank you. Now, I expect that others in the team will be responding to some of the questions and comments. That's how I see it. So I'm turning now to the committee. I see you are here now, Honourable Albert. We were informed of
your delayed flight. You know, you took a flight and then it was delayed or whatever. I hope that doesn't indicate the weather is poor in Johannesburg. But it was it here that it was poor. Okay, fine. So, members, over to yourselves. Honourable Williams, Honourable Albert, right, Honourable MacPherson, Honourable Montash, right, in that order. Honourable Williams.
Thank you, Chair. Firstly, I just want to welcome the input. I agree with you. There seems to be a problem here with this users, performers, owners. Who exactly is responsible for that? And perhaps the DTI needs to give us more clarity on exactly those clauses that were highlighted in this presentation. In fact, I would go further to say the DTI needs to answer to all of those questions that were raised in this presentation, because we can't pass legislation where everybody's sitting and saying, well, we don't know who's going to pay, let's make Parliament pay. I mean, because that's where it's going to go with this. But I also want to just say that there seems to be a trend where this fair use is being really looked at negatively across the board, and I'm a bit surprised by this, because we are moving into the fourth industrial revolution, where one day publishing won't exist. Like, ice companies used to be the biggest company in the world, but when they invented the fridge, the ice company became the smallest company in the world. And I think that we should seriously look at the advantages of opening up our copyright legislation so as to give opportunities from this fourth industrial revolution. And we can't just sit back and say, no, what we're going to do is we're just going to stop everything and we're just going to keep status quo because Britain is doing it and we love the British, and et cetera, et cetera. And I think that we should open up to more, advanced ways of looking at this and not just rely on what we used to do. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Williams. Honourable El.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the presentation. Yes, I would like to know, in terms of the changes made and bringing in American ideas and uses like fair use and so forth, whether a regulatory impact assessment has been done. I know there's a say-so, but specifically a regulatory impact assessment. This committee took a decision in 2014 when a new terms that every single bill before this committee will actually come with a RIA. Now, we have not seen that. Now, apparently, there is a RIA somewhere in DTI lying around on somebody's desk. I'm sorry.
Don't think we've got any other chair but myself at the moment.
Thank you. Apparently there's a RIA and that was published based on the draft national IP policy, and we need to see that, but we also need to see something in regard to the changes that you are canvassing in this bill. And because as the previous speaker, Mr. Hollis, has indicated, what we are seeing here is a change in the structure of the flow of funding or money, and sometimes money not being collected because of the opening up of the copyright principle. So we need to see what the effect would that be on our economy, and whether we are trying to fix something that doesn't need to be fixed, and that our adjustment to the modern economy where we are moving into can be done in a different manner than we are seeing right now. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Albert. Honourable MacPherson.
Chair, just an observation. I'm interested that the Honourable Williams is so passionately keen for American terminology when America is the very antithesis of what he believes is a good communist. So, but maybe that's a discussion for another day.
I think it's a discussion for tea or lunch break or dinner.
We'll leave that for later. I'd like to get some comments on the lack of definition around use and what is usage. And I think it would be helpful if you could provide us for what you believe would be a definition for use or usage. And that's certainly something that we could then could entertain or look at. I also want to just hone in on page 23 with respect to the assignment of rights being valid for 25 years. When you say in your last point there that it shall be unenforceable, I would hesitate that it would in fact be illegal to take away someone's rights after 25 years. Would you share that same view?
Right. Thank you very much, Honourable McPherson. Honourable Montash.
Chairperson, thank you in accepting the presentation. I just want to make a comment. It's not a question for me. I had, when we started, alluded to the fact that we are a different country with a different background. And I know for a fact that it won't be easy for anyone who's been benefiting from this bill in the past to agree for any change. But we stand for one thing, that we want to change the situation, because all the people that we stand for here are those people who've been at disadvantage for their lives. We have seen chairperson, musicians, artists who have been buried as paupers, yet they have made a lot of contributions to the struggle of South Africans. And we cannot close our eyes and believe in what America is doing. We will do our own thing, but we will listen to all what we are saying. But rest assured that we're fighting for the benefit of those people who have over time been ignored and been sidelined by the economy of this country. And that would be my input, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honourable Montash. Yes, I do have a couple of comments and appreciate the response as well. I think the context was referred to earlier this morning. It's important that we not only take into consideration the form, the context, as well, of course, as the legal issues, the terminology, and the jurisdiction. And of course, all of this, no matter what it is, these definitions, etc., on the one hand, one has to comply within international law in terms of the treaties one may be signatory to, for example. On the other hand, we can't ignore the fact that a couple of hundred years ago, if you weren't white, the reality is you didn't own these things. Simple as that. And I'm not aware, but you would correct me, I'm sure, because you have the expertise, but I'm certainly not aware offhand of this having been corrected by, was it the 1978 legislation? I'm just not aware of that, because the reality is the new constitution only came into being in 1994. And there was no need for it to be. So, you know, which would be understandable, of course, legally speaking. So I think that I would like to ask you, because, you know, we have both been in a similar engagement. Miss Duplessis is a doctor, professor, or Miss Ismus, is it right? Yes. Yeah. Right, well, I mean, you know, I'm a granny several times over myself, but I'm the first chair. Now, the thing is that I'm really addressing this to you as well, that you've heard me comment before and others that you do have expertise. We're well aware of that. I know that. But my concern is, you know, we're not getting, although there is a critique on this and that, and including the word use, and I think that is important. If the current piece of legislation, which is before Parliament, this bill, you know, you believe that we've that is not comprehensive enough in this area or not clear, make a suggestion, make a proposal in this regard, you see.
And that's not what I'm getting. And I really am going to appeal to you to come back in writing to us. And as I said this morning, we may well invite you back again. Depends on where we are with this. No, we're not simply rubber stamping anything. And with respect to a task team, no, we won't be looking at that. We will, of course, if need be, bring in a consultant. We will. We have from time to time, as you know, done that precisely. So what we would like to do is to recognize that the members sitting here in front of you are, whether we like it or not, the legislators in this country. And we will seek certain expertise as and when possible. And I think you are aware of that. And you certainly will contribute to our work if you're able, in the areas that have been sought for clarification, to do this. Honourable Macpherson has highlighted this issue of usage, as has Honourable Williams earlier on. Honourable Mantashna has pointed out the issue of context being so valuable. We have an advocate in our very midst here, Advocate Elberts, the Honourable Elberts, who incidentally, like myself, were members of the committee when we dealt with, was it Honourable Elberts, the Intellectual Property Laws Amendment Act. So we old hands at the game, if you like. So as limited as our intellect may be. But having said that, we are going to rely on clarification from yourself. No, we have no intention of simply importing another piece of legislation from another jurisdiction. That's not the idea, but rather to study it for comparative purposes, because we know ourselves that that can be very helpful to us. It's not the final word, and I do believe we can add a lot to what we have in front of us, but at least we've got something. Do you follow? We've got something. We can't wait forever. So we do have something, and you're going to assist us, and other experts such as yourself will be assisting us in this regard. So if you will respond to the points raised and the comments, it will be appreciated.
If I might, Madam Chair, thank you very much for your comments and for everyone's questions. Madam Chair, I just want to mention that, of course, our detailed submissions that were already submitted do contain a lot of proposals. I believe what my learned colleague wanted to point out today was that there's so many issues that need to be looked at and addressed that the law, even though it's an improved effort from the first draft perhaps, and we understand and appreciate the difficult task that the DTI and the drafting team are under to deliver this this legislation, because the legislation touches all industries, so one allowance here would affect a different stakeholder over there. Bearing that in mind, we did include those recommendations, and we make ourselves available for any further engagements. We're eager to participate in the process and to assist where we can. For the Honourable Mr. Williams, I agree with you. It's a very contentious issue. That what do we do to broaden our rights? Do we adopt an open-ended system as in the States, or do we look to our common law shared heritages and sort of see what they're doing? I think we should consider everything. But from personally speaking, one of the issues that we need to address in South Africa, because we don't have a punitive award system which scares people off infringing, it is vitally important that we actually establish with sufficient and absolute clarity when someone is infringing your rights or not. Maybe that's not ideal for every sector. Maybe the tech industry, for instance, feel that an area that doesn't suit the way they like to do business. But the thing is, we have to find a solution in South Africa, and one of the key areas in industries that often are not well represented at stakeholders' meetings or put forward, let's say, eloquent and well-thought and well-researched papers, is our creative industry, our artists, our composers. How many of our wonderfully talented artists and composers and authors have died without any money. And this is one of the key issues we want to address. So when we're looking at relaxing our law to introduce an open-ended system that can lead to, potentially, it might work, it might not work, but the danger of it not working can really damage an already fledgling creative industry, and that is not what we want to achieve. But thank you very much for the question, for the comment, right? Then to Mr. McPherson. The definition of use and usage, we will certainly provide you with written comments and proposals in that regard. And I think there was one more issue that I just wanted to comment on, the 20, that you raised, Ms. Albert, the 25 years. Or did that just get stuck in my mind somehow? That was your question. I'm sorry. Apologies. It's a very good question. I think what's quite important is it's clear where that recommendation comes from. It comes straight from the CRC report, which seeks to address the specific music industry-related matter, where you've got, in the past, we had the so-called Dickens Clause written into a law. It was a bit different. 25 years after the death of the author or the rights holder, the composer, the rights in the music reverted back so that the estate can further commercialize it. It was written out of our law in 1965, I believe. And now the CRC report in 2011 dealt with it at some length to say we need to introduce a legal mechanism in the music industry to assist artists who do not have the appropriate negotiation equality when they sit at the table to sign the contract. And it seems to have been thought that the reversion clause that used to exist in the form of the Dickens Clause should be brought back into our law. If that is the intention, I would propose that it only be restricted to musical works, maybe musical works and compositions, as was originally intended by the Dickens Clause, and also that it be looked at to be 25 years after the death of the author and not from assignment. One of the issues that this could introduce is if you have a situation where copyright reverts back to South African artists after 25 years, some parties, content creators and so forth might look elsewhere to actually engage with artists from other countries, which will once again achieve the opposite of what was intended. It will harm the creative industry. Another quick example of a problem is if you have somebody who designs the Nike swoosh, for instance. 25 years later, after the Nike swoosh has gained and secured a massive market reputation, all of a sudden the graphic designer pops up and mentions that
Could you just explain what you just said? I mean, perhaps I misunderstood you. Nike swoosh.
Sorry, the Nike swoosh, just as an example of a very valuable graphic depiction, yes. So if the bill goes through as it is in its current form that says after 25 years the copyright will revert back to the owner of the original author, you might have a situation where after 25 years of the person who designed the logo for Parliament or the logo for Nike pops out of the woodwork and mentions that he's now the owner of the brand and they must now pay him royalties or millions of rand. So it's an example of how difficult it is to apply one general provision, which clearly in terms of the CRC report was meant to apply to the music business, to all industry concerned. It will pose difficulties in our software development sectors, it will pose difficulties in technology sectors, and that clause, as we propose in our submissions, should either be re-looked at to have specific application in the music business or removed entirely. Contractual freedom is also an important aspect which if taken away, can stifle the growth of many of our industries in South Africa because people will start making films in Namibia and make music export to other countries.
That's a very, very valuable answer that's just been given. And I would just, I would really appreciate it, because I mean, I can go and study the Hansard, but I'd really appreciate it if that could be encapsulated in writing, because I think that that's a very important issue that we need to look at. And specifically relating to the film industry, because, I mean, that is a big, big industry, as you know, in places like the Western Cape, and the DTI has funded, you know, put a lot of money into that particular industry.
The issue, if I may just say, is that we do have a sister piece of legislation in this regard. We're doing this one first, but we have one related specifically to this area. And that's why every now and again we refer to the DDG and say, look, we need to ensure that between the two pieces of legislation, they don't work against each other, but that they complement each other. This is yet another point that has come up in that specific regard. But what the Honourable MacPherson has said, I'm sure applies to all of us, because what you said may have sounded simple to you, it was quite complex to us. So if you would just put that in writing and send it to Mr. Hermans or Mr. Medema, Mr. Holland.
Will do, sir. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the comments as well.
Did you want to just have a last word there?
Madam Chair, I just wanted to remind Mr. McPherson that this whole liberty card... No, I must get closer. I wanted just to remind Mr. McPherson that this limitation of the assignment rights came from the well-known Lion Sleeps Tonight court case, where a local author assigned his copyright in the song, The Lion Sleeps Tonight, for a very, very small amount of money, and later on that became a very, very big sort of income earner. And the reversionary rights still applied. It was prior to the 1965 Act. So I think, and it ties in with what Ms. Montashe said, that one should look at local artists, emerging artists, young artists, who may not have the means to insist on higher rand worth remuneration for what they deliver, but they should get benefit from whatever provisions we put into the Act, and we agree with that.
Thank you very much indeed. And now, members, thank you. And that was the, of course, a whole lot of you there, the whole group, South African Institute for Intellectual Property Law. We're now going to move on to the Copyright Alliance and Reme Gilfillan. They will be done together. I hope you are listening. And that means we will run them one after the other, and then questions will arise at the end. Is that clear? Is that clear to everyone? Right. Now, also during that process, we will have to, at 4:30, I'm going to ask the Secretary of the Committee, Gavin Sabadima, to conduct an election of the chair who will take over from me until I return to Parliament on Thursday. I am leaving earlier, not because I want to sort of dodge my hours of work, but because it was only yesterday I buried my brother, and I still have certain matters to attend to regarding the funeral, in terms of death certificates and lawyers. So I will not be here tomorrow, you see, but the committee will continue. So at 4:30, we will ask Mr. Medema to conduct the election of a chair within my absence. Right. So we now have in front of us the Copyright Alliance. Is that Advocate Jewel Baloy, Counsel for the Copyright Alliance, and Mr. Gabby LaRue, composer and producer. You're both very welcome. And you did understand what I was saying. We won't ask our questions immediately after your presentation, but after vote. I'm sure you saw how that was done this morning. Thank you very much. So who's going to go ahead? It's yourself, Advocate Beloy.
Thanks a lot, and thank you for the opportunity to address the comments. I think perhaps the first thing that I want to mention here. I wanted to just say that I think the first thing that I want to highlight here regarding the very topical issue of the Deacon's Laws or what the 25-year period refers to, while it's still on my mind, in relation to the CRC report, and it's up to the committee how the committee wants to deal with that. But I must say that the CRC report was not dealing with the Deacon's Clause when it referred to the revisionary provision. It's very clear if you go to the CRC report. They specifically say we don't want to deal with it in terms of the Deacon's Clause, but they were actually introducing a provision similar to the one that applies in the United States, which says that 35 years after copyright has been assigned, it has to revert to the author. That's what the provision says in the United States. And the CRC report then says that because the United States has a longer period of copyright, you know, 70 years after the death of the author, and we have a shorter period, we cannot refer to 35 years. We must refer to 25 years. I just wanted to clarify that point. They were not referring to the Deacon's Clause. It's up to the committee how it wants to deal with that. And thanks a lot. Because of time constraints, I won't go, you know, slide by slide in terms of the issues that we wanted to deal with. We have actually, PowerPoint presentation has to be read together with the submission we made. And in our submission, we actually, I think what the committee is highlighting here, because what we did in our submission, we actually took the bill. We took the bill as it is, and then we proposed ways in the bill where we thought that we needed to improve on the wording or things that needed to be removed. That's how we dealt with it. So if, so if the committee could as I said, read our PowerPoint together with the submission, and in each of the amendments we proposed, we actually gave a comment to explain why there is a need for such an amendment. That's what we did in our submission. Thanks a lot. So the Copyright Alliance is really a collective of various organizations from the literary and musical industries, and they have actually organizations, several of them have already presented, like SAMRO, DARO, we have others, PASA also have presented, we have others that have not presented, CAPASO, SAMPRARI, SAMASA, and PASA. And at the time for taking questions, we will actually have some of those that are here to assist in answering questions. We have Advocate Nick Mastukis, who is the chairman of CAPASO, who will also be available for answering questions. And this initiative really arose from a feeling that, out of a sense of responsibility from the persons involved in the management of these organizations to say, we need to sort of come together with the aim of trying to assist the committee in terms of understanding the issues that are of grave concern for the industry, really from the practical point of view in terms of, how would this bill affect our operations, and to sort of, if an opportunity is availed to the committee to say, we can actually come and demonstrate to you how our operations work and how this bill would actually affect, the operations. And really, the position taken by the Alliance is not to be dismissive of the bill as an initiative and to say that it must be rejected. There's a lot of good stuff that is in the bill, but it's really to assist in the process to say what can be improved in order to really make the bill work for the industries. Actually, what we see here is what I call the disconnect between the promise that was given and the actual offering that we are having here. And it could have not been intended, but the effect of the bill, if you read it, is that there was so much promise given, but the offering is actually, is not what was expected. And just to illustrate, several people have mentioned the fact that this bill must not be seen in isolation. There were developments that led to this. Now, the MITT report a while ago, the president's meeting with the stakeholders in 2009, the CRC report itself. And I just want to highlight something here in terms of the CRC report to show this disconnect that I'm actually referring to here, where there were promises made in terms of the CRC report and then a different result from the bill itself. And then I must make the observation also that if one were to go through the bill, if one were to go through the bill and actually look at the proposed amendment, the additions and all that, you would find that between 80 to 90% of the stuff that is being introduced is stuff that has to do with safeguarding the interest of users rather than stuff that has to do with safeguarding the interest of rights holders. You could actually go through the bill and look at that. You would find there are very few instances where the reference is really to stuff that has to do with safeguarding the interest of rights holders. And that's what we mean when we say there is that disconnect between what was promised and what is being offered. Let's look at the CRC report as an example. Paragraph 3.3.8 of the CRC report makes it explicit that royalties payable in respect of daily time rights are to be paid equally between copyright owners and performers. That is very clear in the CRC report. The bill instead refers to the vague concept of fair and equitable remuneration determined by an agreement. It is not solving the problem. The Nearly Time situation, which became a big debacle with case after case going to the court, had to do with this whole issue of sharing of royalties equally between the performer and the copyright owner. And the CRC report recommended that. But the bill doesn't say that. It still refers to fair and equitable remuneration, which can be interpreted in any way. Paragraph 3.3.9 to paragraph 3.3.10 of the CRC report highlighted the problem of inadequate procedures for referring a matter to the copyright tribunal in respect of legal time disputes. The bill compounds the situation by not only failing to provide adequate procedures for the referral of legal time disputes to the tribunal, but by also repealing the provisions of Section 30 to 33 of the current Act. So the provisions of Section 33 of the current Act, which the court, in the case of National Association of Broadcasters versus South African Music Performance Rights Association 2014, had to rely on in the absence of clear procedures relating to legal time disputes. It is noteworthy that in this case, the court decried the fact that it is distressing that, and I'm quoting, the court said, it is distressing that despite a lapse of more than 3 years since the report by the Copyright Review Commission in which it described the regulations as vague and unclear and lamented the failure to prescribe a procedure for the adjudication of a royalty rate, no progress has been made. That was in 2014. In this bill, 2017, no progress has been made too. And then if we go on and look at the issues that are of concern in relation to this whole idea of a disconnect between the promise and the offering. The bill fails in its promise in three major ways. Number one, it introduces provisions from foreign and international law without fully assessing the impact on the local copyright industry. Secondly, it introduces measures that take away existing rights of rights holders
And number three, it introduces an expansive regime for limitations and exceptions, including the fair use regime, without considering the impact on the economic welfare of rights holders and without trying to alleviate this. So the promise was based on the narrative or the rhetoric of artists dying poor, but what we actually find in what the bill offers is something different. And as I said, not everything is problematic with regard to the bill. We have taken up that approach that not everything is problematic, and the bill makes very serious attempts to address certain pertinent issues. Most notable in this regard is the introduction of the right of communication to the public and the introduction of the artist's legal rights. In view of this, in its submission, the Alliance has taken the approach of working with the existing bill and suggesting wording in certain areas to improve the text, as I indicated. In the end, the Alliance remains available to avail itself for a session with the committee to explain its proposed revision of the bill and how the bill can be improved upon to achieve its objectives. And I noted what Honorable Chair indicated, that one of the responses that you would have would be, perhaps they had a public consultation and all that. If it became necessary, the Alliance is available, and mainly really from a practical point of view to demonstrate and illustrate how the bill can be improved to actually achieve its objectives. And the first thing I want to deal with specifically here, in the bill itself and the way that it's drafted, procedural aspects. So there are certain procedural aspects that we need to look at. For example, the bill incorporates the definition of audiovisual fixation and states that it has the meaning ascribed to it in Section 1 of the Performance Protection Act. However, Section 1 of the Performance Protection Act does not have a definition of audiovisual fixation, nor does it deal with that concept in that act. This clearly comes from the Performance Protection Amendment Bill 2016, where the concept is introduced. This, however, is a bill that has not yet been passed into law and has also not yet been deliberated upon by the committee. Consequently, provisions from that Performance Protection Bill should not be incorporated in the Copyright Bill as if those have already been passed into law. That's very important. Logic demands that the department must, in this regard, be patient and first wait for the Performance Protection Amendment Bill to serve before Parliament, and only after it has been passed into law and the concept of audiovisual fixation accepted can the Copyright Act be amended to also include this in the Copyright Act. Second, the bill incorporates concepts from the Intellectual Property Law Amendment Act of 2013, the so-called Traditional Knowledge Act. And I want to say that while this act has been signed and assented to by the President in December 2013, it is not yet in force. Section 15 of that act states that the act shall come into force on a date fixed by the President by proclamation in the Gazette. To our knowledge, this has not yet happened, and thus the Act is not in force. Section 81 of the Constitution provides that a bill assented to and signed by the President becomes an Act of Parliament and must be published promptly and takes effect when published or in a date determined in terms of the Act. So that Act has not yet come into force, and so we cannot incorporate provisions from that Act into this Act, whereas that Act is not yet in force. We are referring to issues like the reference to community protocol, national trust, community trust, and all that, which is included in this bill. That act is not yet in force, and so we cannot include those provisions in this particular act. I'll just go to the other specific issues, and I won't really go through the slides, but I've made my notes here. And in terms of the three areas that I've referred to where we say the bill is problematic, number one, we said that the bill incorporates measures that take away existing rights and privileges. And we have some examples. If you go through the slide, you'll find there are examples there. So example number one relates to clause 3 of the bill, which parties have referred to, which is really an amendment of Section 5 to automatically vest copyright in every work funded by the state. Now, to understand why this is problematic, you need to understand that you mustn't look at Section 5 of the Act in isolation. Look at it with reference to Section 21 of the Act, because they are related. If you look at Section 21.2 of the Act, it specifically refers back to Section 5 of the Act. So there is an interrelation. That is why we are, it's not just, we're not just crying a roof, but these are very serious issues. Now, the real issue here is that under Section 21 of the current Act, which deals with commissioning provisions, copyright that is, created as a result of a commissioning, someone ordered it and paid for it. There are specific works that are mentioned there and other works that are excluded. The works that are excluded include literary works and musical works. Those are specifically excluded there. But if you look at this Section 5 and the proposed amendment, it says in every way. Now,
right, now you've just lost me as an advocate.
Yes.
For lawyers.
Yes.
See, we're going on these slides which you provided us with, and then you referred to example 3 when we were on 7, then 21. I'm looking at 8. Hey, this one, the one we've got up there.
Yes, that is the first example.
Yeah, but you haven't moved on, have you? You need to work simultaneously with your mind as well as the fingers.
Okay, thanks a lot. I'll get to that.
So where are we then? What page? What are we on? Slide 8 or where?
Yes, it's slide 8. What I was indicating was that because the slides are long, I wasn't going to go slide by slide, but I was going to address the issues that arise from slide 8 there. And it mentions examples under,
So what you do then is you say, and then example 3 under slide 12. Because if we wish to make notes.
Okay. I'll do it.
Because you must remember, they're not numbered, the slides.
All right. Okay. Thanks a lot. I'm going to do that, and I'm sorry for. So if you look at slide 8, I understand why you got lost. If you look at slide 8, I'm looking at the issue of improper incorporation of concepts of foreign and international law into South African law, and there are examples there. So there's example 1. So let me deal with that example 1. The example 1 is the introduction of the first sale doctrine in clause 11 of the Act, which introduces a proposed new section 12B. And that first sale doctrine is what is sometimes called the exhaustion of copyright. And I want to mention here that international law, international treaty law, the TRIPS agreement, does not require countries or states to introduce the concept of exhaustion. In fact, the TRIPS agreement very specifically indicates that it leaves this to member states to deal with it. However, the United States has always had this first sale doctrine. And what it means is that once a work has been released to the public, commercially, the persons who have bought copies of the works and all that can then continue to do with the works whatever they want to do without having to pay the copyright owner, any royalties and all that. It is in the US legislation. What we say is a problem when we say an improper incorporation of those concepts into our law is that if you look in the U.S. legislation, although it has that doctrine, it deals with it very specifically in the sense that there are certain works that are excluded from its application. What we have here is, in the first instance, we did not even have a first sale doctrine. We did not have the doctrine of exhaustion of copyright. Now we have the doctrine of exhaustion of copyright, and it is not just national exhaustion. It is taken to the extreme of international exhaustion, which means that it is not only applicable here in South Africa, but even when a work was first published outside South Africa, if you have in South Africa a person that someone that has rights to use the works here in South Africa, exclusive rights in South Africa, and then another gets the work from outside South Africa, and in terms of the bill as it is, even if they did not get the permission of the copyright owner to manufacture the works in those outside jurisdictions, those works can be imported into South Africa without paying the copyright owner. And we're saying that is a problem. If you want to introduce the fair sale doctrine, do it properly. And we would suggest national exhaustion. And if you wanted to talk about regional exhaustion, perhaps look at SADC, but not internationally. And then what you need to do is then look at it properly so that it doesn't affect the market. For example, in the US, the rental of sound recordings is excluded from this provision. Certain usages of computer programs are excluded from the application of this provision. We don't have it in our law, just have an incorporation of that principle. In South Africa, it would affect, for example, owners of copyright in films and sound recordings and all that. If someone has bought films and all that, they can open a video rental shop and just sell without paying the copyright owner and all that. This will actually undo established case law in South Africa. We have a number of cases that have dealt with this issue, like Mr. Video versus New Metro in 2009, Frank and Hish versus Rupinan Brothers, Paramount Pictures, and all that. So we're saying, if this were to be included, do it properly so that it doesn't affect the market. And in our submission, the bill submission, we have made a wording, proposed wording in that regard. Let's look at example two. And the example two relates to a provision that permits the making of temporary reproductions and adaptations in respect of what are called transient or incidental copies. It's something similar like to browsing and caching, you know, in the, yes. So it says that if you do it for that purpose, for temporary reproductions, you should be allowed to do that. And it's in clause 12 of the bill, introducing section 13A. Now, what we want to say here is that this clearly mimics Article 5 of the EU Copyright Directive. The wording is very similar to that. What it does not do is it does not include Article 5.5 of that directive that subjects that particular provision to the so-called three-step test. Now, the three-step test is a test in international treaty law, Article 9 of the Berne Convention, that says that if you introduce limitations and exceptions, you need to consider that it must not conflict with the normal exploitation of the work by the rights holder. It must not unduly prejudice the legitimate interests of the rights holders, and it must only be in specific instances. That is what the three-step test says. And Article 5 of the EU directive specifically requires that if you do this, you must subject it to that three-step test. Our bill does not do it. It merely incorporates that kind of provision. And that is the problem. Let's go to example three. And example three has to do with the introduction of the communication to the public right for sound recordings. Now, we need to mention here, as I indicated, that that introduction of the communication to the public right is a very positive, amendment to our law. However, when it comes to sound recordings in Section 9, it wasn't dealt with properly in the sense that under international treaty law, there is a difference between the right of communication to the public and the right of making available. Now, if you look at that introduction there, it couples these rights together, communication to the public and making available. As if it's one right, it's okay for musical works and the other rights, but not for sound recordings, because under the WIPO Performances and Phonographs Treaty, WPPT, Article 10 and 14 of that Act deals with these rights separately. So Article 10 and 15 is the making available article. Article 10 and 14 is the making available right. Article 15 is the communication to the public. Now, that communication to the public is actually what we call the needed time right. It forms part of that. It is not an exclusive right. It is a remuneration right. But making available is exclusive. So in respect of sound recordings, this distinction must be made clear. So I'm proposing having a separate making available right under Section 9 and another communication to the public right, and then clarifying also that there's a right in public performance for sound recordings to align with the provisions of Section 6 of the Act. And then on the second issue, which says that the bill have measures that take away existing rights. This is what I was referring to, Madam Chair, when you interrupted me correctly. I was referring to the fact that under Clause 3 of the bill, you know, introduces this situation where there is, you know, copyright that is created by funding from the state, you know, vests automatically in the state. And I was referring to the fact that what was not considered is the fact that you cannot look at Section 5 in isolation. Look at it in relation to Section 21, because Section 21 too specifically refers back to Section 5 of the Act. And what then, the implication here is, whereas currently musical works and literary works are specifically excluded from those commissioning provisions of Section 21, with the new introduction, they will now be included. And what that means is what Ms. Mugova was referring to, that the 90 million rand paid by the SABC as an organ of state, because it has commissioned works and paid for their making, which now has to be paid to authors of copyright in literary and musical works, will now be gone. That 90 million, the SABC will no longer be obliged to pay that, because you know, the copyright vests in the state.
Sure.
And that is the problem. The second example in this regard, and related to the first, to what I was mentioning, is the fact that now the amendments also say, remove that reference to say copyright vesting, copyright created or by the state or an international organization, prescribed international organization. Now it says copyright created by the state or an international or a local organization. That is a problem. The reason it's a problem is because what was envisaged by prescribed international organizations was really a reference to, you know, intergovernmental international organizations like the UN, you know, because they are related to the state and all that. It wasn't to any international organization or any local organization. Now, if you simply say international organization or local organization, you're not even defining what international organization or local organization is. Any entity could be described, could fall within the description of a local organization. And that extends this, you know, situation very far. Now, relating to the second example here, is what was mentioned here, the fact that under several provisions in the Act, Section 6, 7, and 8, in terms of Clause 4, 5, and 6 of the Bill, and also Section 9, 8, Clause 8 of the Bill, Section 22C, Clause 23 of the Bill, there is this reference to, you know, author, user, performer, and all that that was mentioned. And what we're actually saying here is, you see, the way that the Copyright Act is dealt with is in such a way that each section deals with specific rights of specific persons. Section 6 has to do with the rights of an author or the copyright owner where the author is assigned the right. Section 7, author, you know, or perhaps the person who commissions the work. Section 8, the film producer and is the author. And then, you know, Section 9 is the copyright owner in the sound recording and the performer under Section 9A. So you cannot have this provision that says author, user, and all that. And secondly, I remain dazed at the idea that there would be something, you know, that would refer to as a user royalty right, because that does not exist in international, you know, copyright law, nor in national legislation. A user is a user of work and must pay the rights holder for using the work. The user cannot expect to be paid a royalty for that. And as it was indicated, if a user becomes a creator, then they are protected as an author, not as a user. In this instance, they now become the author and they are entitled to a royalty, not as a user, but as an author. And I think that is very important to understand. So there were, you know, at times, for example, under this Section 22C3, which deals with collecting societies. And because it does not specifically mention a collecting society dealing with any specific rights, it's just a collecting society. I understand there could be confusion there. The best way would be to, you know, make reference to a rights holder rather than to say you know, offer, performer, and whatever. And in our proposal, we've actually proposed a definition of rights holder, and to say that in that section, you could say that where the collecting society has, the collecting society has to pay the rights holder. And in the definition, you then, if you look at it, depending on the context, that rights holder, if it is a SAMRO, would be the author composer. If it is a SAMPRA, would be the performer or the owner of copyright in the SAMRO. We explain that, and if we do it that way, it would actually help. And then let's look at the example three. Example three actually has to do with circumstances where a collecting society may be suspended or its license cancelled because, you know, it's not operating according to requirements. And that is good. That is welcome. I mean, the CRC commission came because of the demise of SARAL as a collecting society. However, we're proposing that, because what is happening now is saying, once that happens, the CIPC takes over the operations. And we're saying the CIPC, the commission, is not really competent, and we don't think it has the time really to be involved in the running of collecting society, you know, this complicated business of collecting society. So what we are proposing there is have a provision where competent persons, something similar like, you know, the business rescue provisions under the Companies Act, have someone who is competent who will report to the commission. They will be accountable to the commission, but it must be a person who is knowledgeable in collective management, and you could even dissolve the board and have a board appointed.
You will have the opportunity of asking Honourable Mantash, but you're not well. Yeah, okay.
Rest of my concern,
yes,
on the aspersion cast upon the CIPC.
Oh, I see.
Well, I'm sorry. I didn't mean it in a negative way, in a mean way. I was simply indicating that the CIPC was constituted for a particular purpose. That purpose does not include...
No, I think your point is made, but the other point is, although it may have been unwitting, you, in the next breath, spoke about it would be better or whatever for there to be a competent, implying that the previous thing, CIPC, was not competent. So although you didn't say that, it was through implication.
Right.
So, but as long as now you've retracted that, carry on.
Yes, I'm sorry for that. That was not the intention at all. As I said, I refer to the example of the business rescue provisions under the Companies Act, you know, where it says if a company is failing, appoint someone that is competent that can deal with that. All right, let's move on to the third issue, where I speak about expansive limitations and exceptions. And it's not just the fair use here. There are a number of provisions that limit limitations and exceptions. Clause 11 is fair use. Clause 12 is reproduction for educational and academic activities. Clause 18 is used by library archives and all that. And then clause 19D is used by persons with disabilities. And perhaps with regard to this issue of used by persons with disabilities, I want to mention the fact that the Marrakesh Treaty does not refer to allowing, you know, this reformatted copies for just every person with disability. It specifically refers to visually impaired persons. So in other words, what I'm saying is, if my disability is that I have a problem with my left foot or something like that, but I'm not visually impaired, I shouldn't be entitled to this, because this really has to do with a person who is visually impaired, for whom it's difficult to read in a particular format and all that. That is what the Marrakesh Treaty says. And perhaps in closing, before my colleague takes over, I just want to mention the issue of, and I know that...
You've got 3 minutes.
3 minutes, okay. Fair use has been... both of us. If it's both of us, then I think... Yeah, I'd rather give my colleagues.
Thank you, Chair, and good afternoon to everybody and all the honourable members and associates. I'll be very, very brief. I would like to speak on bread and butter issues. I speak on behalf of musicians. Whilst we respect and you know, consider the opinions of many academics and legal people, and we acknowledge your role in this legislation, we believe very strongly that the committee should also hear the voice of the actual creators. I'm speaking with a similar voice as Ms. Charmaine Mkhwebi this morning, who so adequately you know, explained the role and the day-to-day experience of authors. Us as musicians, myself, having been in the industry for 41 years, have been on the receiving end of legislation or non-legislation, regulation or non-regulation in terms of enforcing our rights. Having been fortunate enough to work with some of the biggest icons in the industry, the likes of Mendoza and you know, Brenda Fassi, Yvonne Chaka Chaka, etc., I've seen how music, particularly in our context, can act as a social cohesion elixir. If you say to a young person in a township, you know, get up off your behind and go to work, it will have a certain impact. But if you say to that same person, uzoyithola kanjani hlela konene, it may have a stronger impact. And from that particular point of view, it ties us in with specific revenue streams open to South African composers. And if I say South African, I'm emphasizing that because in our meeting with the President in 2009 and the subsequent CRC reports for 2011, one of the strong issues that the report set out, and that was also the objective of this bill, is to look at inadequate local content in broadcasting. And in the first draft of this bill, we rejoiced when there was a specific clause that in great detail referred to that, down to percentages. That has been removed in the 2016 and 2017 draft, which really led to much, much disappointment amongst South African composers.
Final minute.
I would like to just say that in reference to the American gentleman that spoke earlier, that spoke about this bill will benefit greatly, for instance, the technical sector, but it would not harm the cultural creative. I would contest that it wasn't the intention of this bill to benefit greatly the one sector and not harm the cultural sector. I think that one of the focuses of this bill would be to benefit the cultural sector, particularly the local one. One of our last revenue streams is if our music is broadcast and played on local broadcasters. That is a revenue stream for composers. At the moment, about 80% of that revenue flows offshore because our commercial stations, particularly the advertising heavy stations, are dominated by international content. We need really to get protection by this particular law and also the sister law that's about to follow. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. As I said, when you started off the Copyright Alliance, you had half an hour, just 38 minutes later. So just stretched a bit. But thank you very much. Now, before I ask, and or rather while Graeme Gilfillan is coming, would you just swap seats and then you'll be fine. I'm going to ask Mr. Herman to come here. And as he is coming across to conduct this process, over there. While that is happening, allow me to, on behalf of the committee, to extend our condolences to the Honourable Williams, whose father died during the constituency period, and he's now, of course, the man of the house, as it were, having to take on onerous, and I do mean it, domestic responsibilities, and we certainly, you have been in our prayers, and so has your family, especially your mother. So thank you, know, and now allow me to hand over to Mr. Herman. Thank you.
In terms of the National Assembly Rule 158, we are required to elect an acting chairperson in the absence of the chairperson. Can I have any nominations for the position as acting chairperson? Ms. Van Schalken?
I would like to propose Mr. Adrian Williams as the acting chairperson.
Can I have a seconder for that proposal?
Don't Thank you, sir. I'd like to second the name proposed.
Are there any other nominations? There being no other nominations, I ask Mr. Williams to take the chair.
Yes, excuse me.
Thank you, members. Before we continue, I also want to just express this committee's condolences to the chairperson, Ms. Fubbs, on the loss of her brother. And I think that we should all just recognize that. Thank you. Just a moment. Okay, so we're going to go straight to Mr. G. Gilfillan from Copyright Law UK. Thank you.
Sorry, I'm not from Copyright Law UK. It's just my qualification as a master's. No problem at all. Thank you very much, everybody. Thank you, Honourable Chairperson, Snod Fubbs McPherson, and Honourable Members of the Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry for the opportunity to present today. After a brief introduction, I'll focus on three issues. One, some hard facts about South Africa, copyright in South Africa today. Two, the submission detail. And three, whether the bill need attention. I must say at the outset that the bill does need a lot of attention in terms of legal certainty. This will come up again and again, and it relates to the fact that we are short of good definitions. I'm in complete concurrence with all that's been said so far about achieving better legal certainty, which is about particularly effective in our definitions. I just want to disambiguate when we talk about copyright industries here. Mr. LaRue, who is before me here, is a member of the copyright industries. Very, very, very few people here are otherwise. They're lawyers, they're academics, but they're not in the copyright industries per se. Literary works, musical works, I've just given some diagrams. We can divide these, if we draw a line down the center, into the left-hand side, authorial works, which are the author is the first owner, and entrepreneurial works, where according to our Act currently, the person who makes the arrangements for this is the owner. Throughout, the person who makes the arrangements has always, in South African copyright law, been given to be the person who pays. So when Universal pays for a recording, they own the recording. When the SABC pays for a film, they own the film. They made the arrangements for the film. This is not new. It's not unusual anywhere in the world. So we have these two types of work, authorial and entrepreneurial works, and we need to be quite clear about them. Although they're lumped together, it's been correctly pointed out that they are separate works with separate natures. Just want to make a link in the introduction here to the fact that copyright sits within a broader framework of intellectual property, which we might call the knowledge. In other countries, this has been elevated to a minister, cabinet-level position. So important is it to current economies and the future of life. We can't get rid of the fact that the ownership of knowledge, specifically, I'll repeat, the ownership of knowledge is a key factor going forward in our future, and we need to be mindful of that. In our country, copyrights generally tend to be specifically defined, and I'm addressing all copyrights today except published editions, which is the layout of newsprint, and program carrying signals, which is generally packets between towers. Typically, we understand in the business that rights equal revenue. In other words, if you own rights, you have own and access to revenue. And these rights are typically also assets. They're not just rights arising from assets. The status quo under the current Copyright Act of 1978 as amended has been very difficult. Somebody made the odd comment that it was a robust act. To many of us, it's been a bad act. It is not fit for purpose. It is not. In fact, it has been the act that governed apartheid. Let's just get real. ignorant. This is the act that drove the capacity of the horror of what apartheid was about. And while I know everybody have some idea about our heritage, our legal heritage, and put it up as if it's something kind of special, please keep in mind that legal heritage is very white, very European, and has historically had scant interest in the people of this country. This is a fact. I want to deal with some hard facts about copyright law and copyright in South Africa, which seem to have been neglected earlier. Firstly, authors and composers in South Africa don't own their rights. I owe it to our colleagues from SAMRA. They'll tell you that when you take membership with SAMRA, SAMRA becomes the owner of the performing right, not the author. This is a legal issue. It's done by legal assignment. This has been operating since 1961, meaning that globally SAMRA and its colleagues at CSAC act for their interests and do not act for the interests of the members that they have, because what? The members are just members. They own nothing. SAMRA has extended this to include broadcast, communication to the public, and transmission to a diffusion service. Communication published a tack on, it's not in the law yet. That's the performing right. When a music publisher gets involved, they own all other rights by assignment forever. Now this is, you know, I love the vaunted comments about the interests of the artist here. The status quo that's been running for more than 50 years in this country doesn't give any authors, creators, ownership. It's only the smart ones, like a Black Coffee or a Black Motion or a Giazil Brothers, that gets to understand that they can be a copyright owner themselves, which is what they have done. Performers don't own their rights. They sell their rights to others. That's how they get ahead. Nobody has told the truth about this issue of who owns what right. The fact of the matter is that when a performer signs with a record company, the record company has the exclusive right to record them. And that exclusive right to record means that they own the output. In fact, by contract, they own those recordings forever. The performer owns nothing. It's a fact, except perhaps the right to receive royalties, which is a contractual issue. Writers, well, ask any writer trying to get a book publishing deal. Who owns the rights? So I'm saying in dealing with this issue, because the copyright owner is not the author, and the copyright owner's interests, especially in the history of our country, show quite unequivocally that they have absolutely no interest in the people they represent. And as we get into this presentation, we'll see how this comes to call. I reiterate the point about the fact who owns the rights. And copyright owners are not creators unless they had the knowledge and the capacity to do so. So Black Motion could own their rights. A DJ Cleo can own his rights. A Shifa Shaba could own his rights as a comedian because he sought to own the owners and understood that if he didn't own the owners, he would be forever as an artist in trouble and without rights. With collection societies, it must be understood. SAMRA were to offer their deed here, they would tell you and show you a deed of assignment giving SAMRA the honor of the performing right forever. So no author at SAMRA, no composer is an owner of right, of the performing right. The collection society does. And let me be very clear about the collection society. They belong to groups like FIFA, except they're not FIFAs, but they like FIFAs. They run the sport. So CISEC runs the music and literary work performing industries. Finished. And I've seen them put countries down if they don't want to get involved. They're that powerful. This is not disclosed. IFPI and its protege here, well, not protege, but its representative here, ERISA, and SAMRA, who control the public performing right. These people are not local. They are controlled by a board of three multinationals who have no local shares, no local equity, and no local interest. So just be clear here, when people are talking about the poor artists, the poor authors, the people who are standing here today to represent the organizations did not even consult with their members prior to this. Or if you were on the board, you were lucky enough to be a member to be consulted with. Not one single organization here, especially from the music industries, can offer one shred of consultation before the positions they took. And I'm here to remind you and let you know that their views do not represent the membership at all. The membership doesn't even know this is going on for the large part, except for the last few days, if not 10 days or week, 2 weeks, where suddenly there's been a flurry of activity. And by the way, that has not been to consult, that has been to tell people. Straight up, this is what it is. We're not asking you. telling you.
So who are the copyright owners?
Well, unpacking the so-called copyright alliance is one issue. It's a good way to look at this. They've been given an enormous amount of space at this position, and they all represent one view. The three collection societies, CSAC, IFRO, and IFPI, their representatives here. And it must be known, when you see Darrow, Darrow is owned by SAMRO. Owned. Look at the financials. It is not a separate organization, as envisaged by the collection society issues for literary works. We are three multinational record companies, labels and publishers, and we've got a group of local publishers. These are the owners. I'm looking in the music industries. In the academic industries, we find five academic publishers, and those should note that Germany, the Netherlands, and others have just cut their licenses with Elsevier, for instance. And by the way, this has nothing to do with waiting for legislation that might come out. There are real reasons to stop getting involved with these book publishers, these book people. These are academically, specifically. Yes, they offer peer review, but they also remove access and use money as a way to get in. So you can pay for your own paper that you wrote because you needed peer review. You can pay for it if you want. And if you can't, tough luck. Maybe they'll give you away. So let's get clear about what's happening here with the academic publishers. Look around the world, you see in legal jurisdictions, great case in India that's happened, fantastic jurisprudence that's arisen. The book publishers have been put in their place. And education has stepped forth as a ruler. Royalties and licensing fees, quite critical. You know, in 2000, we would import $245 million, which ballooned in 2012 to $2 billion. By the way, $2 billion would fund the arts and culture department at least three times per annum. Our exports have gone from $49 million in 2000, and despite the Mandela factor, despite World Cups, despite Rugby World Cup wins, despite the fact that South Africa has, to a large extent, been a darling of the world of having improved itself, our exports have only grown to $67 million. What we have is a massive trade imbalance. And this is the reality that needs to be looked at when we consider the Act. If we look at it as a graphic over time, we see this as follows. We see what looks like to be a gorging. Now, the figures here from UNCTAD supplied by DTI, thank you guys. you can get them at the UNCTAD website. That's the United Nations. What we see here is a significant trade imbalance in the billions. And it's not good for our country, but it also doesn't tell us the truth. We haven't gone on that much of a binge to go ahead and just license everything under the sun. There is something rather sinister that lies underneath it. This is the failure of our Copyright Act in the past and why we need a new bill, ASAP. But I'll just make this a bit more brutal, if I may. That deficit, typically when you license South African works, they are licensed from South Africa by the various parties, and they are licensed out to the rest of the world. Out they go, and that license engages use. Now, what's supposed to happen is that money's supposed to flow back. It's supposed to come back here, and distribute it to the people who own it. Instead, we find a practice ongoing since apartheid, and my learned colleagues sitting in the Copyright Alliance, particularly at SAMRO, have the databases that will show and tell this. They know this. This entire misdirection about things is all about these practices that continue since apartheid. So what happens? With the stroke of a silent pen, no further income comes to South Africa because it's assigned to a name. In the UK, it's assigned to a name. In Spain, it's assigned to a name. In the US, in fact, it's assigned all over the place. What that means, one little piece of paper, not disclosed to government, by the way. Not at all. The incumbents, like FIFA bodies here, holding information which is out of the purview of government. So we find this really sick state of affairs in the South African databases. And, you know, one of the things that is really important is that the government currently has no access to data relating to authorship and ownership of copyright works. So we have a wonderful discussion here. But we're not talking at the coalface about who owns and who authors these works. And I'm going to use the national anthem here just to give an idea about what is happening to South African works. as a way of being dealt with. What we see on the first page here is a release by the Soweto String Quartet of the Nkosi Sikelela in Africa. And they have themselves claimed the composition with a gentleman called Graham Beck, which is difficult. He's left South Africa a long, long, long time ago. But this is a new recording done in 2017. And 80% of it is paid to Universal Music Publishing. In fact, via Polygram Music International Music. Where's Polygram International Music?
London.
So what's our national anthem? Why are we licensing our national anthem from London? Well, actually, the growth in our deficit has to do with an apartheid trick, which is to strip our country from its copyright and intellectual property rights, move it off to another country. When apartheid ended, the incumbents just carried on. They carried on, and they are still carrying on. So DTI's big issue with here is the intervention and involvement of the state. And this is what people fear the most. What is the state doing here? They shouldn't be here. This is our private business. Let's look at the national anthem a bit further. Few people know that during the London Olympics, our national anthem was classified as public domain, and then it was arranged by a guy called David Shepherd and published by the London Organising Committee. Wow. So every time somebody won something at the Olympics, who collected the money when the national anthem was played? No cent came back to our country. This is an important point here, not just an emotional point. Who published this work? Universal Music Publishing. Really? Universal is here in South Africa. They have the data in their databases. They all know this. What is really, really hurtful about this is that this carried on in Brazil. This is out of the Brazilian database after the Brazil Olympics. So in Brazil, they used the London-created version with the London claimant on a song with the alternate version called Die Lied van Jong Zuid Afrika. No money coming to this country, not even a record. Let's take this further. We have in the first book, which is visible to those who have it, we have Joseph Shabalala, who's published equally by Blue Chip BV, which is a gala company that doesn't exist in Holland, with 5 bank accounts we identified, and it's published by Kepa Concerto in Italy. We have, again, this is all the national anthem, by the way. We find the national anthem with a public domain claim of 17%, which is done by Helmut Lotti. Now, where does the 17% go? Because according to the domain public, is a composer-author. We find, again, Nkosi Sikelela, published by Warner Chappell. We find Nkosi Sikelela, it's a public domain work 100%, with a composer with an IPI number, as a role of a composer who is NS, no society. We don't know where the money goes. In fact, all of the majors are involved. There are 80-plus collectors on our national anthem all over the world. And the point I want to make is that the data about this sits in the members of the Copyright Alliance, in their databases. None of them have made a point about the fact that access to data is what's missing from the collection societies. Government has no access to data. Just imagine this. A song is a property right. You can go look at the deeds. You can see all the deeds of who owns the properties and who owns them. Companies on the stock exchange, you can see who owns the company. Well, guess what? You can't do that in South Africa with music, songs, recordings. Why? Because the people who are claiming ownership outside of our country.
Sorry. Just to inform you that you have 5 minutes left, and that if you can put your input focusing more on the legislation that's before us. Now, this is quite shocking what you're telling us, but how is it going to fit into the legislation
I'll
before us?
Thank you
very much.
All right. I'm obliged to do this because this reflects a disturbing state of affairs. And into the stage, the new Copyright Amendment Bill. Thank you, guys. You've done a great work. Thank you very much for the effort that's been made to date. We'll see that it's not perfect. And the issue about this bill, which is really causing the trouble, is that it brings the state into the fray. My submission, unless it's disinformation that's been put out, and such disinformation, in my view, is being put out by copyright owners, not authors, and through their representative organizations. And I don't talk about authors who sit on the boards. They are not authors anymore. They are board members, and that changes the whole game. None of them can actually stand up and say that they consulted with members because they did not. Now, it's atrocious when you come to Parliament and you want to make positions that you haven't consulted. All right, they've said the extension of users' rights at the expense of creators' rights. Here's the truth. Owners have been users for decades and remain such. SABC, ETV set up La Lele Music in 2008 was specifically to own all music on ETV. That's true. And by the way, they're members of all these organizations. These guys know it. They're not saying anything about this. The value gap is a phenomenon of the digital age. It speaks to the disintegration of a reproduction right. The cost of making a digital copy is zero. When you times 1 million copies by zero, you get zero. So what's happened is now we're fighting about advertising shares and subscription shares. There is no royalty play left. The reproduction right is destroyed. And if you want to look at what you get for a stream, you'll find that it's an increasing march on the right-hand side of a decimal point. Local creators have clarity for the first time. In sections 4, 5, 6, and 8, specifically it's 50-50. Now, we've never had the 50-50 in before. The people who've owned these rights have never, ever had to be concerned about what the share of the rights was. We have legal certainty, which we seek. And I would agree with anybody that makes for legal certainty. It assists us. I'm not in agreement with the fact that we should be left to the courts because we don't have the capacity in our country to do that. We need assistance with certainty. Automatic usurpation of copyright for composers and authors are commissioned. Section 5.2 added in the words funded by. Now the state has been funding by and owning its creations for a long time. The provisions in Section 4, 5, 6 and 8 tell what the state has to do when it's funded by and those works split it 50-50. The problem is that the state's entry to be an owner is a real problem. The state will sit on the boards. The state will look at the stuff. The state will look at who's claiming on what the state owns. This is problematic. By the way, all these databases are private. They are not public and are not available. Section 21.1c remains unchanged. So a musical work is not going to be owned by somebody commissioning it. And if you don't want it, you don't have to do the job. But the state and taxpayers' money paying for issues cannot be ignored as vehicles to fund the private interests of the few. If SAMRA were to be put on the table here and RISA as to what the top, the bottom two-thirds of their members actually earn per year, it is shocking. It's below 500 rand. You can't run a life on that. The fair use doctrine. You know, Google and co. can't operate unless they have fair use. It's an issue of the digital world. In Africa, they're all breaking copyright, but we are not litigative. We don't have the money to fight them, nor the time and effort and energy to fight. So we need to embrace somewhere in the middle. There are 12 countries, I think it is, in the world, all common law, who have embraced some mix between fair dealing and fair use. In order for us to deal with the digital future, fair dealing is inadequate. It's just inadequate. And for all the piss off on America, excuse my French, which is not a friendly place in the main, they brought digitization. They brought a technology which has changed the world. And we have to deal with that. I've addressed the issue of widening the gap. The widening of the gap has got everything to do with the change in digitization. This is not a copyright law or a bill issue. The local content, well, as long as the committee understands that every time we play something foreign or use something foreign, it costs the country in dollars. That's just something we have to understand. We're a country in development which says that we can actually we can make some changes and we can make some efforts. Is the copyright bill ready? Well, not nearly. It's nearly, but not. All those here today would believe, and I'm at my second last page, would believe that there are tweaks needed. I would agree with all the speakers earlier, although not so vehemently, that the bill is not yet finished, that it does need more work. At the heart of these challenges, though, I think we would all agree, is the concept of improved legal certainty. That's what we're looking for, not diminished legal certainty. The issues remaining with the bill, last page, no clause giving the state access to collection society and copyright owner work, authorship and ownership data. This is absolutely critical. The state needs to know who's doing what with what work if it wishes to check. These are property rights. They cannot be just, oh, I'm a musician, I can't have. Too many terms remaining undefined. This is not good for legal certainty. I've taken this up with DTI before. I'm not in favour and I don't think anybody here is just leaving it up to the courts to try and define everything. There's a very, very, very important issue that's been missed. It's called the Electronic Communications Transaction Act. All culture today is traded as data. It is paid for as data. Now, just like the Electronic Communications Act, which our broadcast for definition of the Copyright Act does not speak to that. If one is going to try and audit MTN for what they sold at Black Motion and one goes to ICASA or tries to get through the legislation, one finds that one has no capacity to do so. Why? because there is no connection between copyright and data, in the fact that we live in a data-driven world where copyright has long been reduced to data as is paying for it. So it's not just technical measures. We need to give more consideration, and we need to bring in that act and to bring the two together. It's the same with the ICASA Act and the Local Content Regulations Act. Both, all of them are missing, if you like. There's no reason why we don't include a dramatic work as a work eligible for copyright. All our trading partners do. It's a work recognized all over the world. There is no reason why it is not included in Section 2. And by the way, last point, amongst the many that we do just for time, is the fact that a sound recording currently does not have an adaptation right. It is the only of the works that has no, but a remix arises, a sample is a sound recording, adapted. It's been put forward, and it's something that would help the local industry in the fact that that right should be in the nature of rights that are owned by the owner of the copyright. Thank you.
Thank you very much. There you have it, members. Members, we're going to take the questions for the last two presentations simultaneously. So if there's any members with questions, now would be the time. Are there no questions? Honourable Albert.
Thank you, Chair. Question to the Copyright Alliance. You've given a quite an extensive analysis of what's wrong with the bill. To your mind, and keeping in mind what Mr. Gilfillan has now shown us, can the bill be adapted to find a balance between the existing state of affairs and protecting authors for real? So I would like you to sort of expose your own agenda in that respect. And then to Mr. Gilfillan, thank you for your presentation. It's very insightful. You've opened up the, I think, power relations that we find in the music industry, or the copyright industry in general. Can you just give us a little bit more certainty about what aspects in the bill are still not correct into your mind, and how the bill will change the world from where it is now in terms of the Copyright Act, and where we need to go to find that balance? Because what the committee would like to see in the end is an understanding that we don't destroy existing systems that create value, but also allow justice and equity for authors and real protection for them going into the future. So perhaps it's a broad question to you, but you gave us quite a broad exposition here. Thank you very much.
Are there any other questions from members? Nothing. What we'll do is we'll answer in the order that you made the presentations. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Case Albert. Relating to the question that you asked, in view of what Mr. Gilfillan has indicated here, can we say that, you know, the bill can protect office for real? I suppose that you wouldn't want us to sort of have a debate with Mr. Gilfillan as such. I think it would be proper, you know, if there was such an opportunity where Mr. Gilfillan would be making his point, and the Copyright Alliance, members of the Copyright Alliance, are given an opportunity to respond specifically to that. Because what I'm saying here is that Mr. Gilfillan has a view. The issue that he's raising, that rights do not sit with authors, but they sit with publishers or other entities. You cannot make that point as a generalization. There are authors that own their copyright in their works. But secondly, it is not a South African phenomenon. It is a position in copyright law itself. Copyright law says that the first owner of copyright is the author, but the author can transfer copyright to someone else. You could talk about, you know, bargaining issues and all that. That's something else. But what I'm saying is it's not a South African situation. Everywhere in the world, in the international treaties themselves, they acknowledge and accept that an author can assign their copyright to someone else. So that is a position. if you look, you mentioned the issue of SAMRO, for example, the fact that authors assign their rights to SAMRO. Many societies all over the world do that, like, as you said, CSEC, societies affiliated with CSEC. But I think we need to note something about a SAMRO, an assignment given to SAMRO vis-a-vis, for example, an assignment given to a publisher. In the SAMRO scenario, if a member resigns from SAMRO, that copyright reverts to the member, and that is clear. It's there in the rules. It's what happens. But what I'm saying essentially is that it is not a South African situation. It is a situation in international treaty law that an author can assign rights to someone else. It happens all over the world. You could talk about bargaining, you know, issues to say that perhaps authors are in a poorer bargaining position. That you can say. But you cannot say that it's a uniquely South African situation and therefore a corrupt situation in South Africa. You need to change the international treaty law. You need to change TRIPS. In fact, in South Africa, if you were to say now that there cannot be an assignment of rights by an author if they want to, you would actually be conflicting with international treaty law, with TRIPS. South Africa would not be complying with that treaty regime. Thank you.
Thanks, Seth Kadavis. Thanks to the committee members. Hope I'm not chasing you. Specifically, I could give quite a long list in terms of, I'll start with the issues that the bill needs. Is that okay if we start there? Look, we have a problem with the issue of definitions in the bill. All right. Definitions are the backbone of any agreement, any bill. They give proper consistency to understanding that bill. We have a lot of words, and I've been mentioned by my colleagues, the whole issues of users, performers, authors all being lumped into one place is no good. The idea that we should go and fight it out in court to go and work out what the meaning is also just, I'm sorry, it's an atrocious concept in South African law. Law is very, very expensive. So the legal certainty factor is one issue can be cleaned up. I'm in favor of bringing in the fair use issues. I think there is more work to be done on the language of the clauses, particularly, and I'm in favor of seeing that fair dealing comes in and finds accommodation with fair use. It also allows us to then sit down properly with the Googles of the world and sit down like Germany and other countries have done with this in our legislation and make new agreements with them. I think excluding the references to the Electronic Transactions and Communications and Transactions Act and not understanding the relationship between data and copyright, I think is a major error. And we will pay for this for a long time, and I'm going to push for it to be brought in. We can't live in a digital world and not have in our law the relationship between data and copyright. There's something that seems to me missing from our law, which I would suggest is in. What the EU did was bring disparate groups of common law and civil law copyright regimes together before the EU could actually trade. And why they got the EC together was they had this patchwork quilt of common law and civil law regimes, much like we have in SADC. So instead of us becoming vassal states, we need to incorporate the fact that we must harmonize with other legal regimes around us in order to create jobs and deal with trade. I've made the point about the dramatic work being included. I make the point about the sound recording adaptation being included. It's something that's done all the time, and yet it is not a right in our law for some reason. If I may, I could talk quite a long time. I could also write a submission of the points that I feel full it would assist DTI and the committee. I'm sorry, the committee. Okay. Is that all right?
Thank you. No, I'm chairing here. So thank you. What we would suggest is that if you've got other written submissions, is that you can send them to the secretary, and then we can carry on with that. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Members, we've come to the end of this very long day. I'd like to remind the members that tomorrow morning there is a meeting starting at 08:30. In this venue, we're going to further discuss the debt relief policy. And then on Thursday, we'll be back into public hearing starting at 08:30 again, I believe also in this venue. But I'd like to thank all of you for staying as long as you could, and for the public and for everybody for staying. Thank you very much, and we'll see you again. Thank you. This meeting is adjourned.